plug in over?
Oh, not at all.
Thanks. Good morning. We will call the April 17th, 2024 meeting of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District to order. Director Slauson, would you like to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance this morning?
Sir.
We could all stand.
If you would please join me in the Pledge to Our Nation's flag. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
May I ask the Board Secretary to give the rules for virtual participation today and then call the roll of the Board and Legal Counsel.
Yes, of course, President Pauley. The guidelines for virtual participation are as follows. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you've joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press star 9 now to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it's your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. If you've joined by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again, and please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are speaking. And now we'll do roll. President Pauley?
Present.
Director Corona?
Here.
Director Slauson?
Here.
Director Armstrong?
Here.
And we have, excuse me, Director Record as absent today, and we do have legal counsel present.
Very good. Thank you very much for that. We'll ask Amanda, do we have any people wishing to do public comment for any items not on the agenda this morning?
We do not.
Very good. And before I turn it over to the General Manager for executive reports, I would like to note on today's meeting, we recently, unfortunately, had two members of the Eastern family who passed away. Sean Doherty, who was a water reclamation operator, too, at the Temecula Valley plant, and Amanda Owen, who was a financial technician. And with the pleasure of the board, I would like to adjourn the meeting in their honor today. So with that, I will turn it over to the general manager.
Good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. And President Pauley, thank you again for recognizing the passing of our recent employees. We are going through a difficult time as an EMWD family, and we're working closely with our team with the Employee Assistance Program representative on site to address issues as needed. My report is included in your packet under new and ongoing items. As the board is aware, last week the Metropolitan Board did approve their biannual budget and rates, and I want to say that the approved budget and rates does incorporate many of the elements that we've advocated for, and specifically a more realistic volumetric sales assumption going forward of 1.34 million acre feet. As the board is aware, currently Metropolitan is falling short of their current volumetric sales projection of 1.54, and in fact they've consumed over $240 million in reserve. So we wanted to make certain going forward Metropolitan has more realistic budget assumptions. In addition, the budget and rates includes $18 million of O&M budget cuts in each year going forward. Also includes doubling of the assessed AV tax, property tax, which is a huge step forward in the right direction for Metropolitan. We've long advocated, and specifically Director Armstrong has long advocated for a more fixed revenue stream for Metropolitan, and we believe this is an important step in the right direction, especially knowing there will be conversations going forward on the new business model. The budget and rates also includes the sale of stored water in Lake Mead to generate $60 million a year for the next 2 years. And for this year, that is actually something that would benefit Metropolitan. And what I mean by that is currently Metropolitan is at capacity relative to its storage account in Lake Mead. By being able to sell some of that water, it does free up capacity. And this year is shaping up to be, as you know, a wet year. We are expecting allocation to increase with an announcement by the state in the next week or so. So if it all comes together as planned, it should be very beneficial for Metropolitan, not only financially, but being able to capture and store more water as well. With that all said, the rate increases is 8.5% per year for the next 2 years. As part of the conversation, there's a couple of things to note. One is there was a significant discussion about the water treatment charge, and there was a commitment by the Met general manager and the chair to include that as part of the upcoming business model conversation. Also, as you know, the assessed valuations, that gets updated every year and presented to the Met board in August, so the formal action on doubling the AV will be in August of this year. I did want to note Director Armstrong's leadership during these conversations and workshops at Met. Frankly, there was conversations that spanned the entire spectrum of perspectives and opinions, and end of the day, Director Armstrong was able to make significant contribution and frankly lead the conversation on ad valorem tax. And that's a huge accomplishment, not necessarily for Eastern, but for the collective, for the entire collective under Metropolitan, because we've always felt that that's what's important for Metropolitan's future. Next, under Metropolitan updates, I wanted to let you know that last week as well, during the Met meeting, Metropolitan did approve a local resource program agreement with EMWD for the North Paris groundwater program. That's a significant financial contribution from Met to allow us to continue to expand our local resources, and specifically the North Paris program will generate over 3,400 acre feet per year. The LRP program is anticipated to provide approximately $20 million over the 25-year span of the LRP program. I will note there were other LRP agreements approved by Metropolitan last week, including one for MODOC for the Doheny Ocean Desalination Project that we are potentially participants in, as well as Las Virgenes and a separate and fairly significant LRP agreement with LADWP as well. Next, under new and ongoing items, I know this board is very much aware of the growth that has continued to occur in our region, but I wanted to maybe just take a note of the growth that we registered just last month alone. Just last month, in March, we connected 700 new connections, water and wastewater. That's about double the average month. Typically, we're somewhere between 300 to 400. That's significant. And when we're advocating on our region's behalf, whether it's at Metropolitan or up in Sacramento, and we want to make certain we can continue to accommodate the growth that we're seeing, these are the numbers that we're seeing. So far, this fiscal year, from July 1st till March, we've exceeded what we had budgeted in terms of what we anticipated in terms of new connections. So far this year, we've connected over 3,400 water connections and over almost 4,500 sewer EDU connections, exceeding our overall anticipated budget of 3,400 EDUs for sewer and 3,000 EMSs for water. So the growth continues, and this is a big part of our effort to make sure we're investing in our infrastructure, in our water supply reliability, to make sure we can continue to accommodate the growth we're seeing. Next, under items of interest to the board, wanted you to be aware that recently staff and myself sent a letter to the Sun City Civic Association in regards to the recent transfer of ownership of the former Cherry Hills Golf Course. As you may be aware, the Cherry Hills Golf Course property recently transferred ownership to Ambient Communities. The golf course has discontinued operation, and there's been a series of community meetings. During some of those meetings, there's been some inaccurate information shared relative to the history of recycled water use at the property as well as EMWD's role. So I felt it was important to make sure we share with the community the history of our recycled water service to the property. And as you're aware, the golf course is one of the first recycled water golf courses in our service area. They became a customer of EMWD back in the 80s. And the recycled water purchases last year when they were still in operation were approximately, in terms of rate, 40% below potable water rates. So we wanted to make sure those facts are provided to the community as the community and the city deliberate the future of the property. So we did send the letter to the Sun City Civic Association, and from there it went to all their members. We did provide an advance copy of the letter to the city of Menifee as well as to ambient communities. Next, I wanted to share, last week, Director Armstrong did host a tour of Metropolitan's Pure Water SoCal facility. We invited all of our retail agencies, including Rancho, Elsinore, Fallbrook, Nuevo, others. I'm trying to remember if I missed anybody. But we had all of our retail agencies, both all the GMs as well as board members were in attendance. It was an incredible opportunity not only to see the facility, and Devin Napatahe, Metropolitan's chief operating officer, was on hand to give us a tour. But it was also a really good opportunity to have conversations and discussions on the drive to Carson and back, talk about the Climate Adaptation Master Plan, talk about Metropolitan's proposed new business model consideration. And we got a lot of good feedback from our retail agencies. And unexpectedly, as you can imagine, the primary concern for many of them is rising cost. And how are we going to be able to manage through the additional costs that as a region, as a Metropolitan, are facing. So really good discussions. And I want to thank Director Armstrong for facilitating and hosting that meeting. And finally, under items of interest, wanted to let you know that our team, including Jolene Walsh, myself, and Pete Evich, had an opportunity to meet with Senator Padilla's staff recently. We discussed our 2025 earmark request for an additional $6 million in support of our South Paris desalination program. They were very interested and very supportive of our request. Essentially, what we're asking for is $5 million that would help us construct the Valley Boulevard transmission pipeline that we've been working on, and an additional $1 million for siting additional brackish wells in support of expanding the desalination program. With that, be happy to take any questions the board may have.
Any questions, Director Armstrong?
Yeah, just on the connection activity, it just made me think there was a presentation or a report at WRCOG recently that kind of talked about where the growth is coming from in our region. I mean, can you talk to that just a little bit?
No, it's a great point, Dr. Armstrong. So we did reach out to WRCOG to get a better understanding, because I think Dr. Armstrong has raised the issue in the past, including the issue at Metropolitan, in terms of we believe part of this, in fact, the majority of it, may be internal migration of Southern California residents, meaning we're seeing certain parts of Southern California lose population, but yet they're moving to our region primarily because of affordable housing, desirable communities. The state, as you know, has very strict objectives relative to affordable housing and new growth. So we do believe, the data that, and the information that we received so far from WRCOG does support that notion that it is primarily internal migration. There's also natural population growth within our service territory. You know, when you have a family living in a house and their kids grow up, not necessarily everyone's going to stay in the community, but some do. And those kids want to purchase a home and stay close to family. So that organic growth is also part of it, along with migration from other parts of Southern California. So it's not so much external migration that's coming into Southern California. It's within the California region or Southern California region. And I think that's going to help us in terms of discussing the new business model at Met. Because when you look at the entire metropolitan Southern California region, there is not much growth as a Southern California region. In fact, as we all know, there's reduced volumetric sales at Metropolitan. There's ample capacity at the Mills plant and at the Skinner plant. So when we talk about growth, we need to not only look at it from our strict local perspective, but you got to look at it from Southern California perspective. And right now, in terms of Southern California, there's not much growth to speak of.
Yeah, and just I think it does tie into the new business model. And I think the affordability aspect of it is also something that needs to be incorporated into the new business model, because affordability is a big issue. So now you have housing now out here that's becoming more affordable. It's very important to make sure that we keep that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
If I could make a suggestion, as I think having Chris Gray at WRCOG does a great presentation on this very subject, perhaps if we could have him come to a future board meeting and and give that kind of data, because I've sat through it, and you're spot on. It's we are the fastest growing area, and it's not necessarily it is a combination of people moving here from San Diego and L.A. So
that's a great suggestion, President Pauley. We will get that lined up. Absolutely.
Okay, perfect. Any other questions, comments? All right. Thank you so much. Let's go this way this time. Matt, do you have anything for us this morning?
Yes, good morning, President Pauley and the board. I do have a handful of updates for you. To begin with, recharge is going really well. This year, river diversions are still ongoing at about that 5,000 to 6,000 GPM rate. With a total of about 2,600 acre feet for the year, we think that'll continue through June when our permit requires us to stop. Also, Metropolitan gave us the go-ahead to begin recharging Saboba settlement water, so we began that on April 2nd. That's also going well. We've already recharged 430 acre feet for the month, and we're at 2,330 acre feet pre-delivered for 2025, so we're doing a good job getting ahead there. With respect to recycled water, we've got storage right about at 90%. We're getting so full it's kind of a challenge to juggle everything through all the ponds, but we got everything topped up. We're at about 10,900 acre feet discharged for this year. If you include Rancho's discharge, that comes out to about 11,500 acre feet. Thankfully, recycled water demands are increasing this week. It's been doubling each day. Yesterday was 15 MGD. So if the weather holds out the way it has been, we do think we're on track to end discharge by the end of April, which is kind of the normal trend for that. We did have a recycled water leak last week on Winchester, just south of Benton, where Clinton Keith tied in recently. That was a pretty big blowout. That's a 24-inch CMLC pipeline that was installed in 92. And when staff excavated the pipe, the opening in the pipe was a little bit larger than the guy's boot. So it was a pretty big opening. It appears that it was caused by corrosion. We've brought the material back so we can assess that. We estimate about 48,000 gallons were spilled. It took about 2 days to repair that and get it back in service. And then the night of the 15th, so two nights ago, as best we can tell from looking at SCADA, a force main failed on the Puroy lift station. It was reported to us in the morning. We had it isolated within an hour and had the leak stopped. But that was an 8-inch PVC pipeline. Unfortunately, it's right next to a drainage creek. Most of the water went in there. At this time, we think the spill was less than 300,000 gallons. We're still working through all the details to get to a better number on that. But at any rate, when staff excavated it last night, we found a 5-foot-long split in one of the segments of the PVC pipeline. So that was a pretty big failure of that pipe. We got it repaired last night and back online this morning. By now, traffic control should be removed. So we're going to take a closer look at that piece of pipe also and see if there's any other actions we need to take with this force main. And that's it.
All right. Thank you very much for that. And again, great job for our crew. I witnessed some of that down there in my neighborhood. So great job. Pass that along.
Thank you.
Good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. Last week, after much anticipation, the EPA finally announced the final national primary drinking water regulation for 6 PFAS compounds, establishing the legally enforceable maximum contaminant levels, or MCLs. MCLs for the two most common PFAS compounds, PFOA and PFOS, have been established at 4 parts per trillion, or PPT, which are similar to the concentrations for those two compounds of the notification levels of 5.1 and 6.5 PPT that were previously established by the California Division of Drinking Water as notification levels for those two compounds. Although the MCLs are similar in concentration, they are not in stature, as notification levels are non-enforceable regulations or limits, whereas MCLs are now enforceable. The new regulations require monitoring and reporting of PFAS in drinking water by 2027, and public water systems will then have 5 years to implement solutions that reduce PFAS that exceed those MCLs. EMWD has been testing for PFAS since 2013, and as federal and state notification levels and health advisories have evolved, EMWD's position has been to immediately shut off wells that exceed those advisories. EMWD currently has 2 wells that were impacted by activities at MARB. One of those wells has since been upgraded with treatment with a partnership and funding from the DOD. The second well had not exceeded federal limits up to this point, and so DOD has not elected to participate. However, with the establishment of these MCLs, we will be working with them to hopefully establish a plan similar to our Well 59 implementation. And finally, on that topic, EMWD has also been advancing a variety of initiatives to mitigate PFAS, both in the bypass of our desalter wells as well as 2 other wells in anticipation of these MCLs. One other update I wanted to provide to the board this morning is on our coordination with the Saboba tribe. EMWD currently operates an interim lift station within the tribal reservation that was sized to accommodate the casino and the resort that was constructed as part of what they refer to as a phase one development. A permanent solution has always been needed, and we have been working with the tribe on establishing that permanent solution that will accommodate further expansion of their resort, but also a septic to sewer conversion for their residents on the tribe. So we have been advancing a preliminary design, but in addition to the technical work that has been ongoing, we have also been supporting the tribe in their pursuit of grant funding. And we've had multiple discussions with the State Water Resources Control Board and the tribe to collaborate on how best to position the tribe to secure that funding, including topics like who is best positioned to serve as lead agency in terms of CEQA and other requirements. And that's all I have this morning.
All right. Thank you for that. Nick?
Thank you, President Pauly. I'd just like to take a moment and highlight the presentation that we made to the Murrieta City Council last night. We did this at the request of the city to provide an update on our Los Alamos Hills project, and really and attending and conducting the presentation was myself, President Phil Pauly, Director Steve Corona, and Roxanne Roundtree, who's been very instrumental in this project as far as community outreach. So for the benefit of Director Armstrong, Director Slauson, President Pauly kicked off the presentation. I was given an opportunity to kind of walk the city council through everything that we've done over the last couple of years to bring us to this point and provide an update on where we are in the construction of the project, which is underway and is going very well. I think the presentation and the update was very well received. We got a lot of good feedback from the city, appreciation, gratitude for the leadership that EMWD has taken on this project to provide a safe and reliable municipal water system to this community that has none at this point in time. They understood the challenges of annexing this area into EMWD, and also was very, very appreciative and recognized the board's actions with regards to supporting this project in the capital cost that was necessary above and beyond the ARPA funding that the city was providing, and particularly so for the creative financing program that we put in place to allow the residents to connect and spread that cost over some time. So just wanted to share that with you.
No, you did a great job. Appreciate it very much. And one of the benefits that is being talked about is the fact that with this ever-increasing rising and cancellation of home fire insurance rates, the fact that we're going to be able to put hydrants up there, I think, is a benefit that was not the primary driver of this, but it's one of those that is appearing to be very helpful to the residents. So,
yeah, the community truly recognized the benefits of not only having a safe drinking water system, but having that fire flow protection as well.
Yeah, so great job. Thank you again for attending. Dan?
Thank you, President Pauly. 2 items of note this morning. First of all, I'm pleased to announce that a familiar face, Jeff Wasserman, has been promoted to our position of Director of Purchasing and Contracts. Jeff has been with us for 20 years, and he's served the past 16 years as our purchasing and contracts manager. So we're pleased to announce that. The second item I wanted to share with the board is that last fall, you may recall that we presented an opportunity to advance a project in our customer service department to implement digital wallet access to our customers. And I'm pleased to announce that last week we deployed that. This will give our customers the ability to pay through Apple Pay, Google Pay, Venmo, PayPal, those forms of payment, just another offering that we provide to our customers to receive payment. And within that first week of operation, we've received over 500 payments through that channel, so doing very well.
I again, appreciate that we are keeping up with modern technology and the way that, especially some of our younger customers, how they pay their bills. And I think we have an obligation to make sure that we're meeting our customers wherever they want to pay their bill to us. We need to meet them at that space. So I am quite pleased, and Director Armstrong was instrumental in that, that we are moving on to some of the digital wallet payment methods for Eastern. So 500 is, were you surprised when at that?
I was with that initial. That's correct.
Yeah.
The vast majority of those were Apple Pay.
All right. April?
Good morning, President Pauley. Nothing from me today.
Thomas?
Good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. In John's absence this week, I'll be covering for finance. I'm happy to report in his absence, I haven't found any messes yet. No, nothing in the closet that's been hidden. So everything's good from finance. Thank you.
Uh-huh. All right. Very good. Thank you all. If there's any questions for anybody, none. We will now move on to item 3 this morning, which is our consent calendar. Do we have any members of the board that wish to have a separate vote or pull an item for discussion? Seeing none, I will look for a motion by Director Corona. Second by Director Slauson. May I get a roll call vote, please, on the consent calendar?
Yes. President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. We will now move on to item 4, which is our action calendar this morning. Item 4A is to adopt a proposed resolution of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District approving a joint community facilities agreement as to form for Temecula Public Financing Authority Community Facilities District 2301. Thomas, you were going to take this item.
Yes. Good morning again. Just for general reference, the district enters into a lot of JCFAs. We've done about 11 or 12 last year and several so far this year. This one is on the board action calendar because this is a unique CFD that the city of Temecula has formed and has requested us to enter into a JCFA with. And this one presents a slight policy exception to the district's debt policy. So I'm here to present the item and make a recommendation that we enter into the JCFA. By way of background, the city of Temecula formed the Temecula Public Financing Authority back in the early 2000s, and it was done through a JPA with the city and its former redevelopment agency. The financing authority was established to fund infrastructure as well as provide funding for the city's CFDs. The Temecula Public Financing Authority recently formed a CFD related to the Altair development near Old Town. And shown here on the bottom section of the slide is a map of the area, or the boundaries, if you will. 250 acres, about 1,083 homes planned, and it's located very near to Old Town. Now, just a quick timeline. This development dates back to 2017, where the city and the developer entered into a developer agreement related to this development. The Altair-specific plan was approved by the city council. It really serves as a planning and zoning document for the development. Fast forward to early last year, the developer petitioned the city of Temecula to enter or to form the CFD, as well as made an informal request of the district to enter into a JCFA related to this CFD. Over the course of the following months, staff worked with the developer, developer's consultant, really to understand the project. We asked for a lot of information. We reviewed a lot of it and ultimately put the item in front of you today for consideration. Back in February, the board of directors of the financing authority for the city adopted the resolution of intention to form the CFD, and they set a public hearing date for March. March, the public hearing came, and it was followed by a unanimous vote from city council, and there was no public comment to report, no complaints for that item. This is just another map pulled from the Altair specific plan. Just shows a different view. Shown on the left really just emphasizes how much open space has been set aside, where that development will ultimately occur. Shown on the right just shows the use of the area, several residential properties, some open space, community centers, and then a lot of trails. Now, I just want to emphasize, this is a unique CFD, which I'll go into more detail on the next slide, but shown on the bottom of this slide just shows how expansive the development is. It's a master planned community that will include several phases of development, five different product types comprising of 1, 2, and 3-story attached and detached homes. Now, I just want to take a minute here and recognize Nick Abdullah from DPFG, the developer's consultant, has joined us here, as well as Colin Cook from Brookfield Properties. Brookfield is the developer of the project.
Thank you for being here.
As I mentioned, this CFD presents a unique opportunity, and I'll just touch on a couple points here. There's a lot that I've included in this slide, but really just wanted to summarize this development. So for this CFD, there's a developer agreement. There's been a lot of fiscal analysis as well as a price point study. I have a slide dedicated to the price point study here in just a few slides. Bolded on the second bullet point is the tax rate. The city, as part of the developer agreement, approved a tax rate of 2.1%, which is above the city's 2% maximum. Very similar to Eastern, in our debt policy, we require effective tax rate not to exceed 2%, and so the 2.1%, that's where the exception is on the debt policy. And I'll touch on that in just a few slides as well. Just want to point out a couple other things on this slide. The widening of Rancho California Road, extension of the Western Bypass, construction of the bridge, and just the amount of acreage that's dedicated to conservation, a couple community civic centers, and then several miles of walking and paved bike trails. Now, as part of our due diligence, we did some due diligence on the city of Temecula. They're very familiar with CFDs. They have 9 active CFDs, including the Altair CFD that they just formed back in March. They've also issued bonds as early as 2002, similar to Eastern Municipal Water District. They also use a strong financing team, similar to Eastern, special tax consultant Webb Municipal Finance, Fieldman as their FA, and then bond counsel with Stradling. Now, bolded here, I want to emphasize this. The special tax within this CFD that the city has formed will not escalate, so the tax is a flat tax, essentially. Some of the other school districts formed by other cities or school districts, or I'm sorry, some of the other CFDs formed by school districts or cities, that special tax may escalate, which increases over time. This one, just want to point out, it will not escalate. Now, on the last two bullet points here, just a couple other highlights of the city's debt program. They're committed to reducing the special tax levy after bonds are issued to just debt service and admin, which presents savings to the property owners. And then highlighted in the last bullet point, similar to Eastern, the city is committed to refunding the bonds and passing on the savings to the property owners as well. Touch on a couple few points here related to the project itself. noted in this slide or summarized here is just how big the CFD and the infrastructure needs are. For Eastern, a big CFD would be a $8 to $10 million funding. A average CFD or a small CFD, would be somewhere between $2 and $4 million. $75 million is massive in Eastern's CFD standards. And noted here, the city of Temecula, with $65 million in infrastructure being funded, greatly exceeds Eastern's $9 million. And so it makes sense for the city to lead the CFD. Here's just a little bit more of a line item detail of the infrastructure. It's a little bit small on this slide, but it really just captures what the $65 and the $9 million includes. Just want to point out, $18 million bridge, a lot of landscaping, a lot of street improvements for the city. And then for Eastern, this infrastructure is related to the sewer fees and improvements that are needed for this development. Now, I want to highlight where the exception is to our debt policy for the board's reference and understanding. With all JCFAs that we are asked to enter into, there's three major components that we look at, one of which is that the effective tax rate doesn't exceed 2%, which is where I've highlighted in this excerpt from the debt policy. The other two components is that Eastern's name not show up on property tax bills that go out for CFDs that we did not form. This one will not include our name. The city has agreed to not include our name on the tax bills. And then the last bullet point, well, it's not bulleted here, but the last bullet point I want to mention is the total dollar amount of the funding the majority will be of the city's and not Eastern's. In cases where Eastern has the majority funding, we prefer to lead the CFD just based on our experience and our best practices in CFD management. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there was a price point study that was conducted. This slide summarizes about a 40-page report that the price point study includes. I'll briefly touch on here, but I'm happy to answer any questions related to the price point study. Now, the price point study was completed by Empire Economics. Joe Jancic, very experienced in this field, and it was requested by the city of Temecula. What the price point study does is it takes the developer's suggested pricing, does a comparative market analysis, very expansive, and ultimately determines what the price points are. Those price points are used by the special tax consultant to establish the special tax rates within the rate and method of apportionment. Now, what the price point study found out was that the price points were 6.8% lower than what the developer's pricing was on average. Now, that doesn't mean the developer priced them, erroneously. And it also doesn't mean that the homes will actually sell for what the price point study, ultimately determined. All it means is that the special taxes will be constrained to be calculated based off of the price point study. Ultimately, it helps the homeowners. The homes will sell for what they are just based on the developer's pricing and the market at the time that those homes are developed. Now, with that in mind, I put this analysis together really to show, and it's visualized here, and I'll walk through it here briefly, but I wanted to show what that means for an average homeowner. Okay, 2.1%, what does that mean? What that means is because of the price point study findings and that the special tax is calculated based off of a lower pricing, that special tax is constrained to a lower amount. And so what that means for an average home price, in this example, $570,000, and let me pause here. There's also just various general assumptions that I had to make in order to make this forecast work properly. So what this means is basically with the ad valorem taxes for an average home price over 30 years, coupled with the other special taxes or fixed charges in their tax bill, as well as the CFD special tax, the special tax or the effective tax rate, rather, will be over 2.0% for about 3 years or until bonds are issued. On average, bonds are issued about 3 years after the CFD is formed, just based on Eastern's experience with forming these CFDs. Now, over those 3 years, the tax essentially over 2% equals about $1,500. Now, that declines every year, so it's not $1,500 divided by three each year. It's a little bit more in the first year, and then it goes down from there. But I want to point out the two bar graphs that I've highlighted in red. That first bar essentially shows the reduction of the special tax based off of CFD bonds being issued. The second one is another reduction that I did assuming that the bonds would be refunded, which the city is committed to doing. So really, at the end of the day, the 2% effective tax rate is shown in the black line. The effective tax rate exceeds that for the first few years and then trickles down after that. And by the end of the 30 years, assuming everything in the assumptions remain constant, the effective tax rate would be about 1.67%. This is my last slide, and just want to summarize what I've shared today. Really, that the City of Temecula's strong debt policy parameters. The Altera CFD will present a policy exception to the district. And I want to highlight that, you know, this is a unique, non-traditional CFD. And if there was a policy exception to be made to our policy, this is a great candidate for that. Now, if Eastern doesn't enter into the JCFA, likely additional school facilities or fees will be pursued to be funded. What that means is essentially there's some mitigation premiums that are required if school fees or facilities are funded with tax-exempt bonds. All that means is that it's just a little bit more of a burden will be placed on the homeowners. With that said, I just want to point out us entering into the JCFA, all it means is that we are agreeing that our fees and facilities will be eligible to be funded with tax-exempt bonds. There's no risk to our ratepayers. There's no risk to Eastern's credit. It's really just including our fees and facilities related to this development to be funded with the bonds that the city will ultimately issue. Now, a development such as this size will have multiple phases of development, and so those bonds are likely to be issued in various tranches over time. It's not going to be $65 million all at one time and slap that on people's tax bills. It will be planned, and as the developer's consultant, work with the city's financing team for every bond issue, they will take a lot of different data points in consideration and size the bonds appropriately to ensure that there are appropriate reserve levels, that there is enough coverage for that to allow for delinquencies, and that the bonds will be issued at a stable point to where debt service can be covered. With that, the recommendation is for the district to enter into the JCFA with the city related to this development. I shared a lot of information, but I'm happy to answer any questions. And like I mentioned, DPFG, the developer's consultant, as well as Brookfield is here. And then we also have Heidi Sheppy from Webb, who would also be happy to help answer any questions.
Director Armstrong, I
believe. Yeah, we had a really in-depth discussion on this item at the admin committee meeting. And my concern at first was a precedent we're setting with the exception to our policy. But I really feel like the non-escalation provision and the price point study really help for me satisfy that it's warranted to make the exception in this case. So I support the item.
Like Director Armstrong, I was there at the admin. I had the same concerns. We're getting a little out of our standard operating procedure for doing these things. You've done a fine job of explaining it, and I appreciate that very much. My question, do you see more of these larger, if we break the ice with this one, are you going to see more other agencies, cities, and things coming to us with some of these larger asks?
My short answer is no, at least for right now. The larger answer, and probably something I'll need to worry about in a couple decades, is that the district is still close to 50% built out. As we get closer and closer to being fully built out, we will have more unique developer planned projects up a hillside. Who knows what, right? The your imagination can kind of take you there. I think right now we're okay, but as cities or areas become more developed, and if the demand for housing continues to be at a high rate, there will be essentially some customized or unique projects that are presented. Now, the district, very familiar with CFDs. This isn't something that we received last week and, I slapped it together for board approval. We take these things very serious and do a lot of due diligence. Probably to the irritation of the developer's consultant, just on how much I asked for, and but I think they appreciate our understanding. Is he nodding? Yeah, I think they appreciate our experience and knowledge for this, and I think that's if that answers your question, President Pauly.
Thank you.
No, I met with Thomas and Joe and Dan. We talked about this project, and yeah, it's a little bit different. It is a very large piece of ground, so I think it's okay, and I'll make the motion to.
Do you have a question?
I feel comfortable with the figures presented.
Motion by Director Corona, second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Gentlemen, thank you for being here for the presentation today. I appreciate it very much. Go on to item B, which is to adopt proposed resolution issuance of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District acting as the legislative body for Community Facilities District Number 20-90, Eagle Vista MV Ranch, authorizing the issuance of its 2024 special tax bonds and approving bond documents as to form. Welcome back, Thomas.
I am here. If you thought the last one was interesting, wait till you get a hold of this one. I'm kidding, Director Slauson. This one's very straightforward. I made the same joke at admin committee. This is related to a bond issue for CFD 2020-90. The CFD was formed in 2022 to finance Eastern water and sewer improvements, as well as Valleywide Recreation and Park District improvements. The CFD was authorized to issue up to $5 million in bonds secured by special taxes. Shown here on the right, there's two different zones for this CFD. Zone 1 is shown up at the top. That's really what is this bond issue is related to. It's about 14 acres up there. Shown on the bottom, it's 35 acres. And I know it looks smaller, but we zoomed out a bit just to show where the relation to the district's headquarters was. Now, Zone 1 is fully developed. It's been developed by Pulte Homes. Zone 2, currently owned by Corona South Main Development, LP. 65 lots are planned for that zone. There's currently no plans for development. The map has been approved by the county, but no permits have been issued for this. Now, the assessed value for this CFD is about $59.8 million. And then due to the development of Zone 1, we did not need to request an appraisal like we've done for bond issues for less developed areas. Based on the AV and current data, this table summarizes basically the bond sale here. The value to lien ratio, very healthy, 35-1. Delinquency levels, 4.3%, a little bit higher than what we'd like. It does fit within our debt policy. We looked into it a little bit further. There's three parcels with about 3,300 delinquent, and that's why that number is as such. This is something we routinely monitor on a quarterly basis. Currently, there's no risk for this, and there will be a reserve fund set aside for debt service. Now, as noted on this slide, additional parity bonds may be issued once the undeveloped property in the other zone is developed. Shown in the bottom table is the data for this bond sale. Projected par amount, $1.65 million. Estimated project fund, $1.3 million, with a TIC of about 5.02%. We ran some numbers yesterday, and I'm happy to report the actual funding amount is a little bit higher just based on current rates. We're looking at $1.37 million, and the TIC is just under 5%. Now, moving on to the team and the schedule, same team we always work with, straddling bond counsel, FA, municipal advisor is Fieldman, special tax consultant is Webb, municipal finance. Just want to recognize Anna from Fieldman has joined us today, as well as Heidi. And then the underwriter for this transaction is Piper Sandler, and Renee Vanchos joined us as well today in support. Looking at the schedule, yesterday we held a due diligence call with the bank as well as counsel. Today we're seeking board approval. We'll be posting the POS tomorrow, and then bond pricing's currently set for the 30th, and the transaction will close a couple weeks later. This brings me to my recommendation, which is for the board to adopt the resolution authorizing the issuance of the bonds not to exceed $2 million. Approve the related documents related to this transaction, and then authorize the executive team to effect the issuance of the bonds. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and we have support from the team as well if there's any questions I can't answer.
Any questions? Would you like to make a motion?
I would move approval.
Second by Director Corona. I get a roll call vote, please.
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 4-0 with director record absent. Thank you, Thomas.
President Pauly, yeah. I have to abstain on the next item.
Okay.
One of my clients owns property that may benefit from the construction of this pipeline.
Okay. And we will note that Director Slauson has left the dais. So item C is to approve and authorize award a contract with WITCA Incorporated for $997,000 and acquisition of easements for the Oliver Street Sewer SR60 crossing project and additional appropriation of $1.7 million. Mr. Stone, good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. Thank you for the introduction. The project itself is going to be a sewer crossing of the State Route 60 freeway located in the city of Moreno Valley. A little bit of background on the nature of why the project's being taken on is Moreno Valley recently updated their general plan and rezoned much of the area north of the 60 freeway, which has generated a lot of interest from the development community. With this new interest, it's also requiring us to expand sewer service to the area. Engineering looked at four alternative alignments, as indicated on the exhibit. Alternative one is the one that is crossing the only vacant piece of property still in that area and available for the crossing. Alternative two and three, and I have a slide on this next that will give a little bit more detail, and alternative four. Alternative one, which is the alignment that we are moving forward, we'd like to move forward with, is vacant parcels. They are planned as a future hotel. This property has been entitled for that hotel. It's preferred because the vacant lots makes open cut construction easier without having to impact local businesses. Alternative two is a landscape area next to the car dealership. This one presents challenging constructions as we already have an existing 24-inch water line, a 24-inch storm drain in the area, and it is at the top of a 15-foot high retaining wall. Which then necessitates a deeper excavation compared to alternative one. Alternative three goes through an existing retail shopping center. This one could impact numerous businesses, including an urgent care center, and again, similar to alternative two, is a deeper excavation. Alternative four is through the shopping center to the west of the property we're looking at. The impacts of the shopping center impacts the fire lanes, but it does have similar depth interactions for alternative one. The estimated cost shown here on the slide of what we believe each one of the different alternatives will cost. The alternative one actually has the actual cost for the easements that we will be presenting today. The others on alternative two through four are estimates, and they do not include potential negotiated impacts or business loss. So, as indicated, our proposed sewer is looking to go through that vacant parcel. It's approximately 1,000 linear feet starting north of the 60 freeway and continuing south to Eucalyptus. We advertised for bids on February 7th. WECA Well, EMBB received 10 bids March 13th. WECA, who we have a representative in the audience here
thank
supporting them.
Thank you for being
them,
here, sir.
Was the lowest responsive responsible bidder in the amount of approximately $998,000. This was about 10% below the engineer's estimate of $1.1 million. For continuing services during construction, we would requested a proposal from Krieger and Stewart, the design engineer of record, and also from Layton Consulting, who were the geotechnical engineers of record. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the property easement acquisition process that we went through and how we developed those agreements. There were three impacted properties that we looked at for the sewer, one on the north, which was a future housing tract development, overflow lot for the car dealership, the Hyundai dealership next door to the property, as well as the future hotel sites. We're looking to acquire permanent utility easements as well as temporary construction easements. Starting from north to south, the developer easement will be the connection to the proposed sewer. It's an easement for our boring pit and working through design coordination with them, and this is being granted to the district at no cost. Moving south of the 60, this is an overflow parking lot you can see in the image to the right. The easement is for the receiving pit for our jacking effort. What we will be acquiring is a 30-foot permanent easement as well as a temporary construction easement. The permanent easement at a value of $40,000 and the temporary construction easement at a value of $3,000. The future hotel easement, and we've got a lot more detail on this in the upcoming slides. As I indicated before, this is a fully entitled hotel property. It is the last undeveloped lot in the area. Our construction there is about 450 feet of sewer. We had a lengthy negotiation with the property owners, which I will share on a future slide. At the end of the day, we will be acquiring a 30-foot wide permanent easement as well as a temporary construction easement for the entire property, including a 50-foot exclusive use area should the property owner decide to move forward with construction while we are out there. So the negotiation, the first bullet here starts in March of 2023. Negotiations actually started with a previous property owner a year before and trying to work and catch up with them. The property went up for sale, and ultimately March 2023 brought us to conversations with the current owners. Our appraisal that we pulled on the property yielded our initial offer of $130,000. MBH, who is the property owner, countered with $450,000. Second offer of $205,000. Ultimately, through discussions with the property owner, they requested to get their own appraisal, which countered offer, which came in at approximately $710,000, which is what they countered back to us. In August of 2023, we made an additional offer of $328,000. And finally, with the help of our general manager, we were able to finally secure negotiations at $351,000 for the acquisition, including both the permanent and temporary construction easements. Our appraisal, originally done in January of 2023, had some deficiencies. Those were not all properties were freeway visible. It included four sales that were a little bit older than anticipated. Not all of the properties were commercially zoned, and it was also for a shorter duration for the temporary construction easement. You can see the specific cost per square foot in the table below. The MBH appraisal was done in June of 2023, had more applicable comps with freeway frontage and visibility properties. The project considers the property as a hotel since it was fully entitled for that purpose. More recent comps, commercially zoned properties, had two specific hotel comps in there and in a more appropriate temporary construction easement duration. You can see below that the subject acquisition was appraised at $28 a square foot and the supporting numbers are there below it. So our final offer, which was accepted by MBH in August of 2023, included a permanent easement for approximately 0.34 acres, which is the 30-foot strip that will run the length of the entire property at a cost of $18.34 a square foot. The temporary construction easement, total of $80,000, includes the entire parcel of 2.73 acres at a cost of 69 cents a square foot. So that brings us to our recommendations, quite the mouthful slide here. But our recommendation is an execution by the general manager for the contracts for the following. WECA Incorporated in the amount of approximately $998,000. Krieger and Stewart in the amount of approximately $44,000. Layton Consulting in the amount of approximately $40,000. Administrative contract award for other necessary items to complete the project. acquisition of a public service easement and temporary construction easements on the assessor parcel numbers 488-400-041, 42, and 43 in the amount of $351,000. Parcel 488-400-40 in the amount of $43,000. Authorization for the Director of Engineering Support Services to take such actions as necessary to implement and administer the purchase and sale agreements, and authorization of the General Manager to execute the purchase and sale agreement as well as other documents necessary to complete the transaction. And finally, an appropriation of approximately $1.7 million to fund the construction phase of this project and bringing the total estimated project cost to approximately $2.2 million. And that brings me to the end of the presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions the board might have.
Questions? Refresh my memory. Have we done business with WETCO before?
This will be their fourth project with
the
district.
Okay, very good. Very good. So, no, and then on the actual construction, is there going to be any disruption to traffic on the 60?
No, we will be tunneling the full length outside of the Caltrans right-of-way, so there will be no... We do have some permit conditions with Caltrans for some monitoring along the freeway with surveying, mm-hmm. just to ensure that everything's staying where it's supposed to stay.
Okay. So,
President Pauly, if I can add, I just wanted to express my appreciation to our team. This has been a long effort. The negotiations for the easements has spanned over a year. Hasn't been always easy. But end of the day, we do have tentative agreement with the property owner to provide us a necessary right-of-way to construct what is a critical facility for the city of Moreno Valley. Also, the bid, as you referenced, President Pauly, with WECA, we have extensive experience with WECA. And frankly, if you look at the bid results, the bids spanned all the way up to almost $2 million. So we have a very good bid, and in the aggregate, we feel strongly this is the best approach for us to move forward with this project.
All right. Would you like to make the motion?
Well, not yet.
Not yet. Oh, you have a question. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, in committee, I brought up a lot of concerns about the price of these easements, which is incredibly high. But, you know, after going through it and talk with you folks, it's clear that this is the only way we can go, and this is the most inexpensive way to go. So I'm going to be for it, but I still am very concerned about what those easements are costing. Anyway, so I'll make the motion to go with staff's recommendation.
Second. Motion by Director Cronus, second by Director Armstrong. You get a roll call vote, please.
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 3-0 with Director Slauson absent from the vote and Director Record absent. So, we'll wait for Director Slauson to join us again. We will move on then to item D, which is to approve and authorize a water supply assessment for the Paris Airport Logistics Center. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. So today, for your consideration, I'll be presenting the water supply assessment for the Paris Airport Logistics Center project. Before we get into the project, I did just want to briefly mention that, as a reminder, these water supply assessments are technical reports that we prepare as part of the CEQA process at the request of a land use agency to advise on whether we project to have sufficient water supplies to meet a proposed project's demands. And with that said, I'd like to introduce the Paris Airport Logistics Center project. They're proposing construction of two industrial warehouse buildings totaling over 800,000 square feet. It's located on an 87-acre area at the southeast corner of Ellis Avenue and Getz Road. The project is actually partially located in the City of Paris Water Service Area. However, the city has requested that we prepare this water supply assessment such that EMWD would be providing water for the entire project. That's for a couple of reasons. The city has determined that their water system would be unable to serve the project site, and also in consideration of the proposed consolidation of the city's water system into EMWD's. Additionally, because EMWD is the current wholesale water provider to the city, the parcels were already considered in EMWD's wholesale demand projections, in our 2020 urban water management plan. And I mention that because under legislation, we're able to reference and include information from our latest urban water management plan when we prepare these water supply assessments. So we do that with a demand comparison. We're looking at that for the project site here. In our 2020 UWMP, we estimated the annual demand for the project site based on business park light industrial land use to be about 215 acre feet per year. And according to information provided by the lead agency and the landowner, the developer, the land use type will not be changing. So the annual demand that we're projecting for this project will remain consistent with what we considered in our UWMP. That's actually kind of cool to see because we typically see projects that come in either above or below what we projected in our urban water management plan because of land use changes. So we do also like to see and consider the cumulative demand across our entire service area. So if we look at the cumulative demand from all WSAs since the adoption of our 2020 UWMP, obviously with the addition of the proposed project, that UWMP-WSA difference doesn't change, but we are still about 1,700 acre feet above what we projected in our UWMP for cumulative demand. However, I do want to emphasize that potential land use changes were anticipated in our UWMP through the implementation of a planning buffer. And while we saw no land use changes for this proposed project, any land use changes that we come across in our planning will be accounted for in our 2025 UWMP. So here we can see that 15% planning buffer that was included above projections that were based on current levels of water use efficiency to account for things like land use changes or rate of development. And this graph kind of shows a summary of the last two slides. So that blue bar represents the 1,700 acre feet of additional cumulative demand. And you can see that even with the additional demand, because of that buffer that we included, we are still well below the actual UWMP projection line. So in addition to the demand comparison, which we saw, In addition to the demand comparison where we saw the water supply projection would be consistent with what we saw in our UWMP, we would also recommend approval based on the cumulative demand from proposed projects being well within that planning buffer. And so we do have about 11,000 acre feet of buffer remaining. And so lastly, because we rely on Metropolitan to help meet demands in our service area through imported water, we also consider planning that they've done to satisfy the requirements of the Urban Water Management Planning Act. And so in their UWMP, it shows that they suggest that they would project to have sufficient supply capacity during normal year hydrology as well as under five-year drought hydrology conditions. So based on the information presented, staff is recommending that the board approve and authorize the water supply assessment for the proposed Paris Airport Logistics Center. And I'm happy to answer questions if you have any.
Kylie, do we have representatives from the developer?
That I know of.
Right there.
There they are.
Thank you for being here today. I appreciate it very much. Any questions on this item? For a motion by Director Slauson, second by Director Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 4-0. Director Record absent. Great job on the presentation. Appreciate it very much. All right. That will bring us to our informational items. Do we want to do the governmental affairs? Because first, or do we want to do?
Yes, President Paul, if we can proceed as planned per the agenda, that would be great.
All right. Let's move on to item. And what we'll probably do is do the governmental affairs, then we may take about a 10-minute break before the Met presentation. So, Amanda, the floor is yours.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. I'll give you a brief update on public affairs' activities over the last quarter, and then turn it over to Jolene to cover government. This is a quick snapshot of the activities that we've participated in the last couple of months. This includes community events, city meetings, municipal advisory committee meetings, Chamber of Commerce, and Student of the Month. This is another snapshot of all the different communications or outreach by numbers. As you can see, we've been pretty busy with some of our video views. Patrick continues to be our most popular. Social media engagements and podcast downloads. We've also worked with about 490 students with classroom presentations, and even more, 560 that we've seen for field trips. This is a look at our digital advertisements, and social media messaging over the last few months. We've focused on desalination, recycled water use, and then encouraging people to use water wisely as they get ready to landscape for the spring. Right now, we're working very heavily with the City of Paris on the water and sewer consolidation project. We've had several e-blasts that went out, direct mail postcards. We have a dedicated website for this so that people can go and get updated information. And additionally, we are coordinating with the city to put out videos that will go on social media. It's a city rep and Alma Ramirez from our group providing updates on what people can expect during this process. The water education program continues to evolve to meet the needs of our students and teachers. In 2023, we went dark for about 6 months. We provided some opportunities for students and teachers, but our field trips went dark while we enhanced them and added some new options. And that includes pre-field trip presentations so that our students are coming to our facilities with a better idea of what to expect, and they kind of don't come in cold and go, what is this? We're engaging activity, or also provided some engaging activities in our field trips for students. So they go through the field trip, and then they get to do an activity that correlates back to what they just learned. And then we're also asking our teachers for feedback. What did they like? What did they didn't? What did they not? What would they like to see more of? West Valley High School and Hemet Unified is the only school in this area doing a water technology career technical education program. In fact, they're one of a handful in the entire Southern California region. And we are their partner in that. So we act as their go-to for anything that they may have questions on. We provide staff to go and talk about careers or do demonstrations. They come here for tours. And so we'll continue to partner with them. We're looking at some summer programs that we can do so that as they recruit new students to come in to the program, kids can get a taste for what the water industry looks like. Right now they have over 40 ninth and 10th grade students enrolled in that program, and it is a two-year program. Additionally, this summer we're launching high school curriculum. We will be one of the only districts in the area, well, actually in the state, providing 9 through 12 high school curriculum focused on water education specifically. This will be meeting both state standards, but also CTE, career technical education standards, so teachers have options to do what they would like to do, whether they want to teach a full unit or all of this in 1 year, or just take and teach like units on their own. So that'll launch this summer, and we will do outreach with our schools. Additionally, we continue with construction outreach. Some of these projects are in ongoing construction. Some are in pre-construction and require a lot of outreach before we actually get out there. So our team is working on those as well. And then our Youth Ecology Corps program, we're actually in the middle of our 30th cohort, and we've been doing this for a while, and it's been very successful. But we're also looking at different ways that we can enhance the program, add new options for our participants and our staff. So we met with the California Family Life Center and Riverside County Workforce Development, including Jamil Dada, a few months ago, to talk about what those different opportunities would be and see what we can implement and what would work to enhance the program. Additionally, we do provide professional development training, but what we've changed this time is that we're actually asking returning interns to provide that training. So they get an opportunity to give a presentation, interact with their fellow interns, and it gives them that experience that they wouldn't otherwise have. Coming up, what we're working on, we do have our first in-person poster contest poster contest recognition in late May. We haven't been able to hold that here in the boardroom since 2019, so we're really excited to recognize our student artists. If you are interested in joining, please let us know. We will honor 12 students from grades TK through 8. This year, we did expand our poster contest to include middle school students, so we have a few more participants. We're also working on a customer satisfaction and opinion survey. We want to hear from them, want to know what they think about water service, their wastewater service, and a couple other questions. So we will be splitting up the survey equally among board divisions. We'll conduct it via telephone, email, text message, and are hoping to have that complete this summer. Over here are some of those key measurements we just talked about. Overall satisfaction, customer service, opinions on water quality, reliability, and availability. And then we also have the website and pipeline redesign that we're excited about. That will launch later this summer or in the next few months. The new website will provide cybersecurity standards, streamlined access to customer or My Account for customers, support interactive online features, and allow for our customization without significant maintenance, which is nice. And then the pipeline, which is our intranet, is in need of some updating, and so that will also be launching with a new system, and it will allow a single sign-on. So if an employee is off-site, they'll be able to access the pipeline, whether they're in network or not. And with that, I'll hand it over to Julie.
Thank you, Amanda, and thank you for the opportunity to present the update. I'll move through my content very quickly so we can get to the next item on the agenda. In terms of the look back, I think the board is aware of our recent activities, our presentations, and our meetings in Washington, D.C., our success, our recent success with earmarks, receiving four separate earmarks in this last cycle. Our Sacramento days, where we had the opportunity to meet with the members of our delegation and advance EMWD's priorities. In addition, we had a very productive meeting with Chair Esquivel of the State Board, really talking about our affordability initiatives, as well as some of the recent consolidations. And we did take the opportunity to talk through some of the regulatory hurdles that we're working to overcome on the recycled waterfront. In addition, we had a General Manager Mawad presented at an event hosted by Senator Rosalys Ochoa-Bogue that was very informative. We also had the opportunity to host the Bureau of Reclamation's Safety Advisory Committee, and members of the Bureau team came from all around the western states to tour our treatment plant and hear about EMWD's safety standards. General Manager Mawad also presented at a UCR seminar on drinking water that was hosted by Dr. Pierce. Moving on to what we have ahead of us, we have a number of bills that we're actively working on. We continue to engage in the negotiations on the resources bond. There are a couple of Prop 218 bills that we're actively engaged on. We're supporting a bill related to emergency water supplies, and then we continue to engage on PFAS-related legislation as well as policy, both at the state and federal level. On this slide, I'd like to point out two things in particular. One is a member of the government affairs team, Wajiha Noor, was appointed to the state board's first ever wastewater needs assessment that will really dive into the human right to sanitation. And the first meeting of that advisory group will be held on July 26th, but we're really grateful to have a seat at the table as those discussions begin. In addition, EMWD has just signed the very first MOU with SoCal Edison to receive their CARES data on their low-income customer database. that we can then match with our customer database, analyze that data, and either use it to better market our existing programs, refine our programs, and even come up with potential new programs to better serve our disadvantaged community. So that's a really exciting endeavor. The letter went to the CPUC early this week, and it looks like everything is moving forward. But Eastern will be the first agency to partner with Edison for this data exchange, so we're excited about that. I mentioned PFAS already. We continue to engage on that front. Right now we're really working to make sure water and wastewater agencies do not assume any liability related to CERCLA as soon as those chemicals are identified as hazardous waste under CERCLA. We've been very active in supporting the Special District Grant Accessibility Act that would establish a definition of special districts in law. And we did get Congressman Issa to sign on as a co-author of that bill. We've been very active with Senator Padilla's office on LIWAP. And then, of course, now that we're done with the last cycle, we're embarking on our earmark requests for FY25. We're also working with the Bureau of Reclamation to lift a policy that they have that caps Title 16 funding to $30 million per project, federal government-wide. So if we have received an earmark from EPA for that same recycled water project that we're not actually able to utilize because of the Bureau's internal policy. So we're working with the Bureau of Reclamation on that. It wouldn't require legislation, so we're optimistic that we'll be able to improve that policy to receive more funding for our pure water project, our PWR project, excuse me. And then our upcoming meetings in Washington, D.C. will start on May 21st. And with that, that concludes the update, unless there are any questions.
Any questions?
No. President Pauly, if I could, again, Jolene and Amanda did an incredible job of summarizing all the activities going on, both on a local, a regional, and state level. I did want to mention one thing. During our meetings in Sacramento with Chair Esquivel, he was particularly interested in the partnership with Edison to be able to essentially establish a model of sharing the CARES data and looking at how we can better serve our underserved communities and disadvantaged communities. So I think he was particularly interested in our effort, and hopefully that can be used as a model for other agencies as well. So thanks, Jolene, again, for a wonderful effort on that.
Great. Yeah, and I'd just like to add first, yes, so thank you for a wonderful effort and all that you do. I think we have one of the premier government relations departments in all of the water world in California, including the fact that you are now chair of the Federal Affairs Committee at AQUA, which you're doing a great job on. But getting back to Amanda, I just wanted to say I am very pleased with what we're doing with the educational component. As you know, it's always been one of my primary goals here is to reach out to the education world, and it's so important today, especially with the high school programs, of trying to attract local talent to perhaps someday come to work with Eastern. So Youth Ecology Corps, IE Works, all of that is really proud of what we're doing. We want to make sure we continue it and perhaps expand it some. So with that, I just want to say thank you for all you do on that. With that, we are very honored today to have the executive leadership of the Metropolitan Water District with us. But in order to make sure everyone is going to give them their full attention, we're going to take a 5-minute break before we get to that.
Good morning, sir. Thank you for coming out here today.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks for taking it.
Hmm. We are very honored today to have the chair and the general manager of the Metropolitan Water District join us and give us a briefing, and I am going to let Joe Mawad do the proper introductions this morning.
Thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. We are very honored to have the Metropolitan Leadership Team with us this morning. We have Chair Adan Ortega, General Manager Adel Haj Khalil, the Assistant General Manager and Chief Operating Officer Devin Apadahe, and Liz Crossan, who serves as a Sustainability, Resiliency, and Innovation Officer. Liz is also leading the effort on the Climate Adaptation for Water Master Plan. Chair Ortega leads the Southern California Municipal Water District, Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. He leads a 38-member board of directors representing each of the district's 26 member agencies across L.A. County, Orange County, Ventura, Riverside, San Diego, and San Bernardino. As chair, he represents district policies and programs nationally and locally and works in collaboration with the board to respond to climate change challenges and ensure a reliable supply of high-quality drinking water for Southern California. Chair Ortega is the first Latino chair to be elected to the post and is the first former Metropolitan employee to serve in this role. Chair Ortega has over three decades of experience in government relations and has helped lead efforts to bring assistance to small community water systems in disadvantaged communities across the entire state. With that, please help me welcome Chair Ortega.
Thank you, Joe, and it's an honor to be here, and it's also kind of a homecoming. I've spent throughout my career so much time in the Inland Empire. I was around when we built Diamond Valley Lake and when we ran our first marathon around the lake. In fact, Darlene Walsh ran it with me back in the day. So that goes back a long, long time. Thank you, Board President Pauly, Vice President Corona, and members of the board and members of the community. Thank you for hosting our presentation today. I want to thank your representative on Metropolitan's Board of Directors, Jeff Armstrong, for supporting passage last week of a budget that begins the transformation of Metropolitan Water District of Southern California to one that's equipped to effectively deal with climate change. I also want to note that Director Armstrong was recently elected to the Executive Committee of the MWD Board, and that I also appointed him to chair the Subcommittee on Audits, which directly reports to the Executive Committee now. The Subcommittee on Audits is the only committee of any type on the board where all members are elected by the board to serve as at-large members of the Executive Committee. The audit function over the years has bounced around our various committees. It was paired, for example, with Ethics and most recently with Finance. An audit late in 2022 indicated that the board needed to better assert itself on its oversight role. It was my judgment that the audit function needed to be part of the Executive Committee, which is the front line in overseeing department heads and the body that sets our agency's agenda. In a little over a year since he began serving on the MWD board, Director Armstrong has earned the universal trust by members of our board, and he now leads those members on the executive committee elected at large as those that monitor our internal controls and set the tone of financial and operational accountability at Metropolitan. Thank you, Director Armstrong, for sharing of your time and talents on the board of Metropolitan.
And thank you, Chair Ortega, for all the extra work. I appreciate it.
There's more coming. As MWD Board Chair, this visit comes at a time when Metropolitan and our member agencies face enormous pressure to reduce our reliance on imported supplies, beginning with the Colorado River. On the Colorado River, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation expects us to produce almost real-time results showing in the form of higher lake elevation levels at Lake Mead. In the current water year, we have left over 450,000 acre-feet of water at Lake Mead through investments in conservation and supply offsets. In due part because of our efforts and those of our partners throughout California, levels at Lake Mead today are equivalent to those in 2021 before the current crisis was triggered. In fact, we have maximized our accumulated storage at Lake Mead with 1.77 million acre-feet of water, about 12 feet of the lake's elevation level. These investments on Colorado River-related conservation programs are funded in large measure by federal grants. Nonetheless, these programs are not free for you or Metropolitan. The conservation achieved through these programs is compounding already steeply declining water consumption and water sales revenue. Metropolitan's board has taken initial steps to address this paradox through a newly adopted budget for 24-25 and 25-26. In August, we will be increasing the ad valorem tax while keeping volumetric rate increases in the single digits on average. We realize that there are inequities to resolve, such as the treatment surcharge. That's why we are accelerating the planning process for the new business model that is part of our climate adaptation master planning process, known as Camp for Water, which will be discussed by our general manager in a few moments. But please, don't get me wrong. We're not fixing a failure, but shifting to address climate adaptation. It demonstrates that the last 25-year planning horizon that saw real integrated resources planning with an emphasis on local projects has worked. Many of you know Deborah Mann, the former COO at MWD and my former colleague. When planning conservation programs in the early 2000s, she would often challenge me to quantify the return on investment in conservation. It has taken me 24 years to answer her question outside of the abstract, but here it is. The return on investment in conservation and local projects is 2.4 million acre feet of storage out of 3.4 million acre feet in total in our various reservoir and ground storage accounts, and it's worth approximately $3 billion. Because of good weather and conservation, we are currently in storage conditions with only a 30% allocation. Last year, for example, with over a 100% state allocation, we ran out of storage capacity in our system, prompting the need for increasing future groundwater storage opportunities. So the time has come to ask, where will we store all the water being conserved by our customers, as well as from the good hydrological conditions we've had? In fact, it is a paradox that of our time that in 2022 we faced a crisis in portions of metropolitan service area because we could not move store supplies from Diamond Valley Lake, which is nearby here, to our northern reaches after the state reduced our state water project allocation below 20%, which over 25 years stood as the worst case scenario. I mean, understand what that means. When we built Diamond Valley Lake, we didn't build distribution systems to connect the entire system because we assumed that we would never face anything worse than a 20% allocation. But we did. We were down to zero, and we had to request health and safety supplies for a 5% allocation that year. There are other inequities in our system that have resulted from past assumptions that we must now update. Turning to the Bay Delta, as we consider more investments under Camp for Water to shore up levees and restore the environment, here are some factors we might consider. As I stated, we need to make investments on projects that will yield fast results on the Colorado River. The lawsuits in the Delta over Delta conveyance, the water quality control plan, and the voluntary agreements can take decades to resolve. So what can we do besides wait? Agencies in the Central Valley, some of which rely on San Joaquin River water, that were once hesitant to involve Metropolitan in groundwater projects, are now asking us to consider those very investments as a hedge against subsidence from groundwater pumping as the Sustainable Groundwater Act goes into enforcement. Just imagine what that means. The San Joaquin runs south of the Delta before it empties into the wetlands and the marshes and the levees. And so there's opportunities to perhaps do something there. Can these provide opportunities south of the Bay Delta as we weigh the risk of more delay and impasse in the Delta? Could it be that we can help save portions of the Central Valley from more subsidence before we can do our part to save the Delta? This is a long way of saying that in the present, the issues related to the Colorado River, the Bay Delta, and our local supplies are interwoven like never before. The goal of Camp for Water is to unite and fortify Southern California in this changed environment by strategically integrating with our member agencies like never before. Climate change is challenging us and our water systems even sooner than our modeling projected. We must act now to adapt, to make smart, effective investments in new water supply strategies, storage, and ways to improve and move water throughout our system, as well as consumption and sale, as well as during a time when water consumption and sales revenue are declining. The test of our time is whether the financial challenges and the measure of regional equity across Southern California with the changed climate will strengthen us or leave each member agency on its own. Now I'd like to turn this over to our general manager, Adel Hajikhalil, who will give you a more narrow and specific briefing on what's going on at Metropolitan.
Thank you, Chair Ortega. Good morning. President Pauly, board members, Joe, and Director Armstrong, it's a pleasure to be here. When I joined Metropolitan in July 2021, the first agency I came to visit was Eastern Municipal Water District. I remember coming here and meeting with Director Randy Record and also with Joe Mawad, because I understand how critical the work you do here. And I always, as you know, I've used this one water message that we need to address our future needs through integration, innovation, and inclusion, and diversity, holistic solutions. I can't think of any agency that's already practicing that than Eastern Municipal, whether it's recycling water, desalting, conservation, reuse, all the great ideas. So I want to acknowledge you for the leadership, acknowledge you for the work you all are doing, and the partnership that I have with the general manager, Joe Mawad, and it's an honor to work with you. But also, I want to acknowledge both the previous director of Metropolitan's board, Randy Record, but also Director Armstrong, who has been a great leader. And really what I appreciate about Director Armstrong is he comes in with fresh ideas, but also willing to think about the entire region as a whole. Not just about, I mean, he represents Eastern very well, but also the future for us to move forward is to work together as Metropolitan, 19 million people, 26 member agencies. We need to collaborate and figure out how we meet the future. And we need to all thrive. And I use the message that our job is to ensure safe, reliable water for everyone with no one left behind. And that only can be done through holistic solutions, integration, collaboration, and inclusion. And I appreciate his leadership in ensuring that that is done. And we're doing it together. You know, when I came in, I wanted to engage our member agencies. I want to make sure every member agency, small or large, are engaged. We've had member agency managers meeting, but recently I've actually started having a small group of just the general managers and myself meeting to do a strategy discussion. Because I look at the 26 general managers are my partners and colleagues. That together, they are my counsel and advisors. And I want to make sure that we're talking, we're getting their feedback and input to plan for the future. And I appreciate Joe. He's always been a sound general manager working with me on ensuring that we look at the entire area and figure out how we incorporate your input, but also the input of the entire region. We're building relationships. We're building partnerships. And that's the future for all of us. Metropolitan has been created 100 years ago to bring us together and build the infrastructure to move water here. The future of Metropolitan is the same thing. It's come together to help us provide resiliency and how we can capture water and put it in the ground or the reservoirs, how we recycle water, how we ensure that we protect our imported water. At the same time, how we can resilient. The future, I mean, we saw what happened 2021, 22, as the chair mentioned, some of our communities ran out of water. When we built Diamond Valley Lake, when you built Diamond Valley Lake as a board, and we have it, it was a vision that people thought, you know, why do you want to build that infrastructure back in 2000? We know what the value of Diamond Valley Lake is when we had that drought. But we found some issues that we need to build more resiliency and conveyance, and that's a part of our investments. And that's what we're doing. You know, we need to balance supply and demand. Our region, the beautiful part of our region, it's a diverse region. some of our regions are growing and some of our regions are not growing. We may have supply in one area, but we may not have supply in another area. Your region is growing, and we need to find ways how we can ensure that your region is supported by the water that we provide. I'm proud that we were with Director Armstrong and Joe, and I think President Pauly, when we started the tunneling operation not far from here at the Marsh Air Force Base for the Paris feeder extension. I'm glad to report it's 50% complete, and by early next year, we should have it completed. But also how we can move water in the system. We don't have to recreate water. I mean, water is going to be expensive, and we know what we need to do. But through this climate adaptation master planning, we need to balance demand and supply and look what we need to do to adapt to the future climate. How are we going to move water when we have it like we have last year and this year and put it in the ground, above ground, how we recycle water when we need it, and how we build the infrastructure to move it around. Conservation is a way of life. We know that, you know that, and we've been doing it. The good news, out of the 3.4 million acre-feet of storage that we have today, record storage, over 2 million acre-feet, as the chair said, because of conservation. And we're looking for ways to how we can monetize some of it so we can invest more in conservation and the work we're doing. We're also knocking on every door, trying to bring help from the state and federal government, because the message is investments in Southern California is an investment in the entire state, investment in the entire Southwest. It's critical to our economy, critical to everyone. We're a $1.6 trillion economy, the 11th largest economy in the world if we were a country by itself. So the investments are critical. So when we do recycled water projects and do the work we're doing here, we need the help of the federal government. And that's what we're doing through our efforts right now. We've applied, we got over $220 million last year in grants. But this year, we're applying for over $500 million in grants. And a large part of it is out of the Inflation Reduction Act. And I want to acknowledge that we work together closely to frame that system to support underserved communities through conservation direct install, but also support local resource projects and work on the work we need to do together, build storage. And 40% of that work will be dedicated for underserved communities. And that's a big step. And hopefully, we hope by early next month, we should be hearing some news from the Bureau of Reclamation. But also, we work together with your team on advocating at the state level and also at the federal level. The good news is Congresswoman Napolitano just introduced yesterday legislation to extend the large recycled water program to go beyond 2026. That's the program that we worked hard to create to ensure that one is we support Title 16 and it's moving forward. I'd love to support your efforts to remove the ceiling. That's a great, great thing that we need to do. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we can sustain that funding for the future. It's not one time. And working with Senator Padilla, which we appreciate his leadership on affordability, by introducing legislation on, for the low-income assistance program. That's a great, great effort and great work that we are doing together. We know climate is changing. We're seeing hotter and drier days, and we're going to see it. People ask the question, you know, we don't have a drought anymore, right? 2 years, we should be okay. The answer is, for the time being, we're okay. But our job is to plan for the future. We're going to see 3, 4 years or 5 years of drought, and people are going to look at us and say, did you plan for this? Because if we have a drought, we can't respond. We saw what happened in 2022. Nature threw us a lifeline. We had to adapt to it and capture it. But our job right now is to build the resiliency that we're doing together. I'm proud that our board last week sent a message that we want to invest in Metropolitan. A strong Metropolitan is a strong region and it's a resilient region. The budget that was approved sent a clear message of what we need to do and how we need to support it. At the same time, we need to do more cuts with more efficiencies, which we did about $160 million in efficiencies that we reduced and looked for ways to bring new revenue in, over $120 million in additional revenue. But also the board approved local resource programs. One of the projects, four of them, for $250 million, supporting 100,000 households, close to 250,000 people. One of the projects is your project here in this basin, in cleaning the groundwater and also protecting the groundwater basin. So that partnership is there. We see what you've done, and we continue to be a great supporter of you and look forward to continuing to work on it. But also we're looking at ways to build the infrastructure, but also find ways to store water because, you know, we know how the delta is. It's, as the chair said, it's It's very unreliable, and we know it's one earthquake away from failing and one flood away from failing. So we invested $200 million in underground storage, over 300,000 acre feet of storage in Lancaster, Antelope Valley, East Kern. And we're putting water in the ground, equivalent to Lake Castaic. That's a huge investment that we're doing. And that's what we see the future of our climate resiliency and how we need to work on it. The Colorado River, I mean, we know what we dealt with and how we are almost had a crash for the Lake Mead, and we had to figure out what we need to do. California stepped up. We actually, I'm proud of the leadership of the chair by bringing California together. We cannot be divided. We support ag economy. We support our urban communities. We support the environment, our tribes. We're all together, and that's a partnership we have done, and we continue to do together. A year and a half ago, we had six states against California. We were able to turn that around, and we were able to rebuild that relationship with Arizona and Nevada. Arizona and Nevada are big partners in our recycled water project, the Pure Water Southern California, because they see the investments here can help take the water from the demand that we have on the Colorado River. The river is actually in not bad shape right now. We are seeing increase. Metropolitan last year put in 450,000 acre feet in Lake Mead. The level is up by close to 17 to 20 feet higher. However, we're still not out of the drought. And the Bureau of Reclamation said we need to cut. We need to cut almost 3 to 4 million acre feet. So the first phase between now and 2026, we agreed to do the cuts, and California has stepped up by our efforts, and we got some funding from the Inflation Reduction Act. And that helped us also financially with Palo Verde Irrigation District and others. But beyond 2026, we have new guidelines that we're negotiating right now. We submitted a proposal. It was not a seven-state proposal. It was a lower basin, Arizona, Nevada, and California. We submitted a proposal to the Bureau of Reclamation, and we're very proud of what we provided. We committed to cutting our use by 1.5 million acre feet a year from the demand and supply, basically addressing the structural deficit. But we argued beyond that point, all has to be shared with all the states. Every state has to share. So we're protecting our imported water, but at the same time, we're taking responsibility. And that's going to take all of us. We know so our water in the Colorado River is going to go down. We know that. But we need to find ways how we can put some more water in storage. And that's what we're doing. That's why we are investing a lot in storage and partnership with our ag community. On the Northern Sierras, the snowpack is good, 125% of normal, percent of normal, which is good. But we all know it's going to be how we manage the water when we have it. Last year, we didn't have the capacity to store 450,000 acre feet because also we didn't have the conveyance to move it. We're building relationships with the groundwater basins right now to move water when we have it and find new ways to partner to put water on the ground here in the basin, but also doing it in the central basin. Now, how we can partner with partners? The chair and I have been talking to a lot of the community farmers. There is discussions happening in how we can address SGMA, which is the groundwater subsidence program, and how we can put water when we have it available in the ground to help bring up the groundwater level and stop subsidence to help the communities in the ag community in the area. But then if we need the water, we're able to access that water. So we're looking at MOUs. Devin and his team is working on partnerships with Delta Mendota, with Friant and others to build those relationships. It'll be more to bring forward. But we need to think differently. It's about collaboration and partnerships, and that's what we need to do. Camp for Water, we need to find ways to balance demand and supply. How are we going to do it? How are we going to need to plan? It's a risk management approach, how much risk we want to take and how much investments we're going to make and how we ensure affordability is on the table. All these things are being discussed. And next week, on the 24th, we'll have our first workshop. It's going to present the one-year progress, but also it's going to present the start of the business model review. Metropolitan's business right now model that we have, or revenue model, it's about supporting funding through sale of water. And we know we're not selling water. How can we sustain the investment and resiliency while we are pushing for not selling water? If we're a business, we'll be out of a business because I'm paying people money. We're investing in people not to buy water. So the sales are going down. That means revenue is going down. At the same time, our cost is going up to invest in resiliency and the aging infrastructure. So we're in a place right now that we short our resiliency financially for next 2 years, but our job right now to find a new way to ensure that we can create the revenue to invest fairly, equitably, address inequities, as the chair mentioned, but at the same time, we're able to sustain us to ensure that we're doing the right investments. And so we're going to be creative, and it's going to start next week. Conservation is still a great thing. We've continued to look for new programs. The last program we did is to actually provide tree rebates. We call it tree bait. Five trees for every household that converts to a California-friendly drought landscaping. In addition to the $3 per square foot, we are given tree baits because trees not only provide shade and shelter, but also captures water and put it in the ground. And that was done in collaboration with the chair and the late leader in Tree People and the CEO of Tree People, and then also the council member from the city of San Fernando, Cindy Montañez. That's what his vision, and we're glad they were able to do that with her mom recently in the San Fernando Valley. What you're going to hear next from Devin Apartheid, the executive officer, Devin has been really working hard on thinking outside the box and building partnerships, building agreements. And you're going to hear from him of ways we're going to manage water supply in the future, how we're going to build partnerships. You're going to hear about how we're going to protect our imported water. Also look at exchange. We've talked about last week at the board, exchange idea. If somebody has water, how we can move it in the system to benefit somebody else. That's going to be at the table. And also how we move together in the future. And then Liz Crossan will give you a little update on the climate adaptation master planning and how we're moving forward. But I'll just tell you, it's Metropolitan is the umbrella for all of us. That's how we're going to move together through partnership. But also it's a net, no one left behind. We need to make sure that nobody is left behind. Every community, every city, every agency should be taken care of. Because this is all about us working together. And this is the fresh look that Metropolitan has. How can we plan for the next 100 years together to ensure that when people turn the faucet, they'll have water? And I'm just proud to have you as a partner, this agency as a partner. You're a great role model. And the partnership with your leadership at the board, your representative at the board, Director Armstrong, and your general manager, Joe Mawad, and his team has been amazing. We have created partnerships. We just sent a collaborating meeting about cybersecurity. We're trying to share information. We created a grant collaborative effort relationship with our member agencies. We continue to work together on our legislative priorities, on our conservation messaging, because we're all together and we need to leverage our resources. We can't do it alone. The cost of doing it alone is too cost prohibited, and it does not make sense. We need to do it together to move us into the future. So thank you. Let me turn it over to Devin Apartheid to give you through the water supply discussion and then to Liz Crossan afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adele. And good morning, President Pauly and General Manager Mawad. It's fantastic to be here with you all today. I can't think of a better kind of survey overview of everything that Metropolitan is doing than what you just heard from our chair and our general manager. And my task is really to hone in and focus on kind of four areas that are guiding us going forward. These are things that we're doing now and also things that we're looking at in the future that you can consider when you're thinking about Metropolitan. And I want to start by acknowledging a great success. This is something that Chair Ortega touched on. The background here is in the 1990s when we were doing our planning and we were looking out, we were actually looking out to 2020, which is now in the past, but we were looking to the future. We were thinking, how much water might we need from the State Water Project to be in balance in a typical year? And the answer to that question was we thought we would need a 75% allocation on the State Water Project just to balance, to meet needs. And what you heard from Chair Ortega is this year we've got a 30% allocation and we're in balance. And I think that is a great marker of success for the efficiency gains, the local supply development that has happened with your agency and others here in Southern California to really be able to manage with a much lower amount from the State Water Project than we were thinking just about 30 years ago. So one of our directors at that time, His name was Langdon Owen. He was from the Orange County area. He had a quote that impressed me, and it impressed our planning department at the time. What he would say is that we need to plan to replace half of our supplies every generation. Just to keep up, we've got to plan to replace half of them. I think that that's borne out to be true, and it's in that spirit that I would offer these four areas that we're focusing on. The first area is managing our needs for imported supplies. This gets to the support that you see recently with the approval of your LRP contract with us and continuing to support the development of local supplies with our member agencies. Following through with efforts to limit non-functional turf going forward, to support our agencies in their compliance with the new regulatory package that's coming through the state board, through our rebate programs. In fact, we engage with your team regularly to look at what are the new things that we might need to be doing, new rebates that we might be adding to help you all comply with that more efficient future. The second area is thoughtfully defending our core supplies. And I say defending because for the foreseeable future, the State Water Project and the Colorado River Aqueduct will be important core supplies for this region. And I say thoughtfully because the old way of managing those supplies will not serve us in the future. And an example I will give you is Adele talked about the package that's being negotiated in the Colorado River. We only have operating guidelines that last through 2026. New books will have to be written for the way the Bureau will operate the river post-2026. And he also mentioned that we have partners like Arizona and Nevada that would like to invest in a major program we're doing here in Southern California, our Pure Water Program. That program could be the largest water purification program in the United States. They want to invest in that. The rules on the river right now prohibit that. We have an operating structure that would not allow another state to invest in California and receive some benefit on the river. So part of what we have to do is negotiate a new structure that acknowledges that we are under the same umbrella and that Arizona and Nevada could receive a benefit through us leaving water on the table in the Colorado River if they invest in a project that produces water for us to use here in Southern California. So we're trying to be innovative in the way that we're thinking about defending our core supplies. The third area is increasing supplies available to Metropolitan locally here within the region in Southern California. And that gets to the Pure Water Program that I have mentioned, a major new business model for us that we're looking at, where right now every drop of water that Metropolitan delivers is an imported supply. This would change the game. It would be a new locally developed supply. Another piece of that we're looking at, an innovation that, in fact, your team has been working on us to look at, is there a way for us to use our system to support one agency, like Eastern, investing in a local supply developed by another agency and receiving that supply via exchange through the Metropolitan system? A new policy development and innovation that we've never done before, but it could be catalytic in new local development and investment in Southern California. The fourth area is a really big one, and it's modernizing how we manage the system. And in this regard, we are developing new pumpback systems. You had heard about the State Water Project dependent areas in our system that largely depend just on State Water Project. These new pumpback systems that we're looking at will allow us to move Diamond Valley Lake water all the way up into their service area, all the way up into Ventura County, as an example, so that they're able to benefit from those supplies in drought years. But the innovation there is that the team is looking at, if we could get DVL water up there, what about additional interconnections that would allow us to pump Colorado water up there? So it isn't just stored water. It's one of those core base supplies that would then be able to get throughout our system everywhere. We're also, under that category, looking at other major investments that we believe would modernize the system, things like Sites Reservoir, things like Delta Conveyance, to better be able to deal with climate change in the future. The great news here and through this process, you will see,
we see a future where there are more opportunities than we need to be reliable and resilient. That's a good problem to have. But how do you decide where you're going to invest? What's the right price point? Which of those options do you choose out in the future? And that's where the Climate Adaptive Management Plan for water comes into play. This is the process that you heard both Adon and Adele speak about. And our manager of sustainability, resilience, and innovation, Liz Crossan, is leading that effort. I'd like to ask Liz to come up and talk a little bit about that process of decision making. Thank you.
Thank you, Devin, and good morning. Nice to meet you all. It's a pleasure to be out here at Eastern. Hello, Director Armstrong. I'm going to talk a little bit about the what we call the CAMP for Water, the Climate Adaptation Master Plan for Water. And I want to start off by saying that this is an extremely collaborative and inclusive process where our chair had Chair Ortega had the idea of not just having this be at a board level decision, but to actually integrate our member agency general managers into that decision making and deliberative process. So he has established a task force that includes both Director Armstrong as well as General Manager Joe Mawad. Both have been, you know, extremely engaged and thoughtful participants in that task force. And that task force is leading the development of this master plan. And the master plan is really to take what I think you all are very familiar with, our integrated resources plan, and to integrate that with what we do on climate planning, financial planning, infrastructure planning, so that it really creates this umbrella where we can integrate the planning processes at Metropolitan and look and institutionalize a decision-making framework that really helps us make those tough decisions that Devin was just talking about on the investments that we're going to need to adapt to these changing conditions. We have developed a process that is iterative, it is adaptive, and it is really meant to be a nimble process where we will be making decisions on specific investments, but we will also be tracking real-world information. Are there changes in population? Are there changes in the economy? What are our supply and demand changes that we need to be aware of in the imported, on our imported sources of water, in the climate science as it develops, so that we can change the assumptions in a way that really helps us make the best and most informed decisions. And I want to talk a little bit about, you know, where this is coming from. I think we're all acknowledging that things are changing in a more rapid way than maybe we anticipated, and we've, as Devin just mentioned, we have seen some vulnerabilities exposed in our system, especially when it comes to our state water project dependent areas, which was really one of the catalysts to embark on this process of developing a plan that really helped us look at all of those vulnerabilities and make decisions based on the best available information. So we started this process in February 2023. We had a retreat with our board in your service area in Temecula, where we all sat and talked about the climate impacts that we are seeing at Metropolitan on the ground today. So we're really used to dealing with drought cycles like you all are. We understand the necessity of having water when it's available and putting it into storage when it's not. We recognize that there are changes in snowpack as well as runoff shifts from you know, later parts of the year to earlier parts of the year. So we have some differences in the way we need to operate. We also recognize that lower levels in our reservoirs like Mead can impact our power supply. And so that not only impacts our ability to access renewable energy, it also can increase our costs dramatically if we have to rely on purchasing that power. So those are kind of the drought impacts we're all used to addressing. But what we also talked about at that first workshop was, what about all these other climate impacts? And not in a sort of removed, we know that there's more wildfire, we know that there's extreme heat, but how are those things actually impacting our operations? And they certainly are. Extreme heat is impacting the Colorado River. We've seen wildfires really close to some of our treatment facilities, like Deamer, in recent years. We're also seeing sea level rise as a serious threat in the Bay Delta, and so we have some strategies around levee and enhancements and ecosystem restoration that will help address sea level rise. We're also thinking about impacts to our workforce and the way that we move our folks around. And so what this Camp for Water process does is it incorporates all of those threats and helps us develop a decision-making framework where we're thinking about each project and program as they come to the board, and the board can evaluate them according to what is the reliability of this project we're considering? What is the resilience in the face of these threats? What is the flexibility and adaptability of this program or project to actually work within our system? What are the affordability implications, the financial implications, as well as some of the environmental co-benefits that we're seeking to achieve? And so that's this framework that we're setting up. We will be evaluating projects and programs through a decision-making framework that our board has been very, and our general managers have been very involved in developing, that really focuses on those factors. And it is really rooted in our IRP needs assessment. So we are utilizing, you know, scenario planning, which is, I'm sure you're aware, a best practice in water resources planning, because it is a, it's a great way to deal with the uncertainties and for us to be able to move through different future scenarios that we may face. So as we move through this process right now, we're actually going to be presenting next week sort of the whole picture of all of these elements I've just mentioned, how we'll be making decisions so that we can then start actually evaluating projects like Pure Water Southern California, Delta Conveyance Project, Sites Reservoir, and others that are under consideration at Metropolitan to help inform our board. Ultimately, the board makes the decision, but this is an important input of saying, how does it really measure up against the priorities you all have communicated to us? And so we will start doing that process here soon. And then, as General Manager Hush Khalil mentioned, next week we're also embarking on the next steps for this process, which includes talking about our business model, talking about policy objectives related to climate adaptation and partnerships that we need to form, many of which Devin mentioned, as well as how is this going to work as an adaptive management framework for Metropolitan moving forward. So really excited about how far we've come, and again, really appreciate the involvement and great thought leaders that you have here at Eastern that have been part of the process. Thank you.
Thank you.
So in closing, President Pauly, members of the board, you've heard Adele, Devin, and Liz describe a new type of planning and new classes of infrastructure and define adaptation and resilience. So resilience is not just the act of avoiding mistakes. Resilience is gained by surviving setbacks and learning lessons from them so that we can come out stronger. Metropolitan and our member agencies have time and time again proven this fact, and we are now stronger for it and positioned, as Devin stated, to avoid the shortcomings such as those we faced in 2022. You have a farmer on your board. I regret it is not here, Randy Record. But in large degree, with climate change, humanity as a whole has been forced to admit what probably farmers have always known, that nature has the final word and that we have to learn to listen to it better. And that is the first step to adaptation. So Camp for Water, plain and simply, is aimed at the certainty of uncertainty and preparing for whatever nature brings us. So with that, we're open to any questions if you'd like to indulge them.
Very good. And I'll point out, luckily, we have another agribusinessman on our board here, Steve Corona. So, I like to call it agribusinessman. I also want to, before we get to questions, acknowledge we have many of our friends from the Rancho California Water District board members in attendance today. So thank you, friend, including the general manager. So thank you all for being here today. But, yeah, if you're able to answer some questions, Director Armstrong, why don't we kick it off with you?
Okay, I just want to start just saying thank you for coming and bringing the team that you brought. I didn't know everybody was coming, but it's wonderful and it's a great update. And I know that you guys are making the rounds to every member agency, and I just applaud you for that. I think sharing the information and also listening is going to make this whole process better. So thank you. Adele, I just wanted to touch on one thing you said. You talked about all the good things that Eastern does here. And, you know, we're doing pure water, recycled water, desal, all those things. But, you know, this region, all the agencies out here are doing those things. The Rancho district is doing those things. Elsinore, Western, we're all doing those things. And I think we're doing those because we've had to over the years. And we talked a little bit about agriculture, and we appreciated a week or two ago, Met staff came out to Rancho and their farm managers meeting and gave an update. And as a result of that, I've talked to Director Quinn and asking her if we can't maybe bring some of these efficiency efforts that are happening out here in agriculture to some committee meeting to share so that the rest of the board is really informed on the agricultural part of what's happening out here. There's a lot of really creative and beneficial programs out there. So I'm just sharing that because I think that's another one to add into that bucket. But I also want to thank the chair and you, Adele, and your team, you know, on the budget. I think it was, since I've been on the board, this has been the most robust and fun, engaging discussions that we've had on the board. And there's a lot of priorities that different member agencies have. There were a lot of new ideas, but you know, to thread this needle and pull this together, where there was a lot of compromise and yet a lot of progress, it was really a great job, Don, for what you did to make that happen. And I don't think it just dovetails into the new business model. I actually think it is the beginning and integral to what the new business model is going to look like. And so with that, I just want to say thank you. And then I have a question for you on the new business model. I have two questions. One is, could you talk about your thoughts related to tiered rates in the future? And could you also talk about, do you know, a lot has changed in 100 years at Metropolitan. Some of the agencies that were heavily reliant on Metropolitan for their water supply aren't as reliant anymore. But yet the governance structure and the voting structure remains the same. Do you see governance evaluation as part of the business model as well? So those are my two questions.
Go ahead. I think these are great questions. So next week we want to frame the different things that we need to deal with and define what is that business model review is going to look like. What are some of the key principles, right? We never thought about the governance structure, but at some point, I mean, we need to also think about it, but that's something that we'll decide as we move forward, but it's something you can put on the table. I think the anchors that I'm looking at, and all, first of all, is making a stronger financial ability to pay for the resiliency investments, and it's shared across the board and how we do it in a affordable way, but also equitable too. Then awarding conservation. We want to make sure that whatever we put in place is rewards conservation, acknowledges conservation. But also, if you use more than what you're supposed to use, you're paying for that. It's not amalgamated across the board. Plus, also allowing for exchange. That's an idea that we want to make sure that the chair talked about it. Devin talked about it. We want to figure out how we can move water in the system because there is a change in supply and demand. There is agencies that are growing, there are agencies that are not, and we should not reinvent the wheel everywhere, but we need to figure out, can we move the water in a fair, equitable, what kind of financial system we need to look at. So if you look at, you know, the board will and the process will go through, but a vision that I have is there's two components of this. One is the resiliency portfolio that will be determined by the CAM for Water investments over the next 20 to 25 years. That investment is resiliency that we think is going to be shared across the board. And that's the first component, and we'll figure out how we pay for that. The second component is when you buy water, the volumetric sale of water. And I think there should be some recognition that, you know, you can't just amalgamate all the price into one price and everybody pays for it. Maybe there's a way that if you are conserving, you stay at a certain rate. If you're using more water, you go to the next rate. And if you're using more water, you go to a third rate. And that can be aligned with the sources of water. So we have imported water that Devin talked about. We have recycled water. And we have probably in the future desal or high expensive water. How can we access that and distribute that and at the same time be fair with the cost of service? Those are things that we're going to deal with. It's going to be determined by the board, by the task force, by the member agencies. But this is going to be transformational. Whatever we do, it's to move us in the right way where we ensure sustainability and ability to pay for the investments, but also assuring affordability and rewarding for conservation. And those are at the table.
Yeah, I'd like to address the issue of governance, because it's something that I've thought about a lot over the years. Working with small water systems throughout California and being on these panels to talk about drought resiliency and the preparedness of small water systems, I've had a good view into where the governance structure could go when it comes to water. You have LAFCOs, for example, that have been to some limited degree influential in some areas where we had to address resiliency and governance. You have the counties who are known as primacy agencies. And there's nobody better prepared and equipped to deal with water than the structure that we have today. Just to give you an example, I was on the state drought council for small water systems, and it was called the county drought resiliency task force. Only two counties showed up. I went to the county of Los Angeles that was working on a master plan, and they kept calling us about small water systems. I told them, you got to show up. And the primacy agencies have turned their backs on the small water systems because they don't have the money to deal with it. So I think that there has to be some transformation in the way that we govern water statewide, that it doesn't begin with us, that it begins with the systemic malfunctions that we have now. For example, we have the human right to water. We're bending over backwards to comply with safe drinking water regulations that are imposed by the state so that our customers can enjoy safe drinking water. Yet, we can't guarantee, and the state's not guaranteeing, that our customers can drive from one end of the state to another and have 100% guarantee of safe drinking water. What does that mean? You know, we have the limitations of Prop 218. One of the things that I have an affinity with Eastern Municipal Water District is the way you've taken ownership over the small water systems in your area. By one means or another, you're out there helping to bring equity to everybody in the access to safe drinking water. You know, we talked about earlier, you were talking about being able to influence the state with some of the projects that you're building. I think you can influence the state with the philosophy that you bring to the table. And so I hope that that's something that we can do together. It's something I'd like to do during my term as chair, to break that argument open on the human right to water and have a governance system in the state that really works for everybody and that meets the promise. But I can't see giving up your role or compromising on it with agencies that are not as focused and not as well equipped.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Director Slauson.
Yeah, I don't have any questions. I really think you and your team have presented a lot of information. I appreciate it. And you know, I got to say, I feel a lot better about MET and the water industry, knowing that, you know, you guys, with that knowledge and the things you're going to address in the future, how you plan to address them, seems right on, and I appreciate you guys coming out. I really, really do. Thank you.
Director Corona?
Yeah, once again, thank you. Thank you for coming out, Adon and Adele. I wanted to ask you a question about something you brought up earlier, talking about refilling groundwater basins and the like. You know, last year the system was just totally taxed trying to get water into Met's reservoirs and things like that, and there really wasn't much of an opportunity for districts to use water to fill their groundwater basins. And, you know, cyclic was kind of suspended and all. And I know we've got Rancho water people here today. I spent 16 years on Rancho's board before I came here to Eastern. And I just kind of want to know, how are we going to do that this year? one of the biggest problems for districts like Rancho and Eastern, I mean, it's pretty expensive water to use for recharge or to fill Vail Lake. And my guess is Rancho could probably take 100, 150,000 acre-feet of water, fill their basins and fill Vail Lake. But the price for this is pretty expensive, especially when you're putting in an underground basin and you got to pump it back out again. You got to make sure it's clean and chlorinated and all that, provide to everybody. So it's almost like by the time you're done, you maybe end up spending the same amount of money as you would have if you just simply bought treated water from Met. So it kind of defeats the purpose. So I'm wondering if Met is looking at any type of price discount or something that will help the districts get back into putting more water into the underground basins.
I think it's a great point. That is something that we've been trying to address. So we have the cyclic program. We have a new program that we're looking at also. But also what we've done is actually brought in the groundwater masters and the basin managers with our member agency managers just to have a dialogue. You know, for a long time, I'll just tell you, I mean, when I asked the question is, a lot of the groundwater basins wanted Met out of their system. Leave Met out, we don't want you. But I think we need a future that's different. So, you know, you heard me talk about, and Devin talked about in the chair, we're even talking beyond just the in-basin, we're talking about outside in putting water in. Metropolitan, I think, needs to look at ways that we can utilize the available space in our groundwater basins to put Met water, the regional water, in the system to use that space and figure out how what kind of agreement. But the agreement has to be such that if we need that water, we're able to pull it out for the benefit of the region as a whole. That's the new model. It's going to be part of the business model discussion and part of with the Camp for Water, because we need to find new ways. And I think the old rules that we had in place cannot be in place, because the only way for us to really put water in the groundwater basins is through a purveyor, somebody that has water rights there, and they have to buy water from us. Is there another way where we can still go with an agreement with the member agency or a sub-agency that we can provide excess Met water that we can put it in the ground, as long as there's an agreement that we can pull the water out when we need it? So there's discussions that happened at the board, I think, a few months ago about it, the volumetric assistance program, but also there's some other ideas we're looking at. You know, in discussions with the people north of us here in the Central Valley, there's actually some ordinances for counties that says you cannot import water out of our basins. How can we put water in if we can't get it out? I mean, but we need to change those rules and figure out the future management. But I agree with you. This is the cheapest way of doing it, is to utilize this existing storage that we have in the system.
Thank you. Mr. Corona, I think, or Vice President Corona, I think that's an extremely it's an extremely important question, and I'm so happy that Rancho Water's here. In fact, I was mentioning to their general manager, Rob Grantham, I was with another sub-agency, we shouldn't call them sub-agencies, a local agency general manager yesterday. And I noticed that a lot of these sub-agency or your member agency managers are coming forward. I was just invited to do a tour of Elsinore Valley Water District in the coming weeks. I think that's the next challenge of our engagement, that we need to bring them in to this planning process. We've invited the general managers to sit with the MWD board over the last year. I think we have just about all of them. We're going to start in with the board presidents. So, President Pauly, we hope to be able to welcome you at Metropolitan at one of our meetings to participate in the meeting. We're going to begin with Mel Katz next month, president of the San Diego County Water Authority. We'd like for you to follow, just given where we're going on some parallel-type discussions. But the important thing is you represent those constituents. And we hope that we can inspire you to do what needs to happen, and that we can support so that you're listening to your customers, so we can do the kind of arrangements especially in these adjudicated basins where you're going to have to amend judgments in order to be able to do some of the things that we've talked about, even at a lower price.
Thank you. So let me ask one. You hear it, Chairman. I hear it from our constituents, from voters. We've given you guys all this bond capacity for storage, and yet we still see all this stormwater, rainwater go out to the ocean. You know, we're taking a look at sites here at Eastern. I know Met is involved with that. So with all we have going on at Met with Pure Water, Delta Conveyance, could you just give me some of your thoughts on the site's reservoir and what the Met investment may look at and the necessity of, I truly believe, as a water community in California, if we are going to keep the general public, the voters, on our side, at some point we have to show them we're doing something with this bond money.
Well, I think you're right, but I don't think we've been up to it. I met recently with the executive director of Restore the Delta, and you know the topic of Delta conveyance came up. And what she indicated to me is that they're not that concerned about Delta conveyance. They think they have us over a barrel because of the lawsuits and the permit challenges. What she indicated to us was that she's now focused on the voluntary agreements, which cuts at our core supplies through the Delta, where 85% of our water must go through in order to get to us. To me, the issues around the challenges to the water quality control plan, to the voluntary agreement, strike at the heart of whether sites could be a viable project for us. Because without there being some measure of reasonableness in the regulations on these flow requirements, we may not get any benefit out of Sites Reservoir. The top half of that water in that reservoir would be dedicated to the environment. And if you take these challenges seriously, any hope that we would have in the purchases of capacity in that reservoir may not happen. And that's not a new story. We have a 2.3 million acre foot entitlement to the State Water Project. On average, all we've ever gotten is 800,000 acre feet. So can we as a region continue to make these investments for less water? We've spent $500 million in investments in trying to gain goodwill in the Delta. We spent $200 million on Delta conveyance in the last iteration, and we have less water to show for it. So I think that one of the things that we need to do is think about, as we're waiting because of the gummed up legal process, we got to do something else. And as I indicated, it may be possible, might not be the most ideal thing to recover these groundwater basins in the Central Valley south of the Delta, but it might be the best that we can do. But it also entails the people in the Delta having to face up to the fact that they're going to share a greater burden for the things that must be done in the Delta anyway, like flood control and preserving these levees. So I don't think we can continue to be as generous as we have in the past and to give away the store. We want sites to be viable. We want Delta conveyance of some form to happen and improve. But until we change our posture, they'll have us over a barrel.
Thank you. I know our general manager had a question.
Great. Thank you, President Pauly. Chair Ortega, Adele, thank you for being here. Your presentation has been comprehensive. We truly value the information you shared with us. And I do want to acknowledge both of you for drawing in the general managers from all member agencies to be part of the conversation going on at Met. There are very significant decisions ahead of us all collectively. I did have a couple of questions. I do want to acknowledge last week we were fortunate that we brought in our wholesale water customers, our retail agencies. We had a tour of the Pure Water SoCal. Devin and his team did a marvelous job of highlighting the projects, and the benefits of the program are without question important and critical for this whole region. But frankly, the feedback we had from all of our retail agencies is concern about the cost of the program. At currently estimated at $6.4 billion. And how will we, frankly, fund such a huge program? And I recognize there's potentially other partners outside the state, as you indicated, Chair Ortega. You know, one of the questions I have relative to Pure Water, I know Met has been successful in securing $80 million from the state and pursuing additional significant federal funding. Is there an implied commitment by Met to the state and to the feds to go forward with that project? Is it still possible to increment the project, to consider the timing of it, given all the other priorities, frankly, that are currently being contemplated as part of the Camp for Water process? The second question is just a little bit broader, Chair Ortega, and I think I was fortunate enough to be invited to one of the listening sessions at Met. What I shared at the time was that Eastern became a member of Metropolitan in 1951. We were honored to become part of the family. In fact, our history is intertwined with Metropolitan's history. Throughout the last many decades, we were there for the collective when growth was occurring in L.A., in San Diego, in Orange County. Now growth has shifted to our region. Now we are the highest growth region in the entire state. And, you know, you can sit and discuss and look at what is growth really. Because as Southern California, as metropolitan service area, there is really very little growth within Southern California. It's just that there's an internal migration potentially of individuals moving out to affordable housing, to desirable communities. So one of the questions I had is, as we embark on this new business model, what are those levers that you see that can be potentially utilized to help us address the long-term financial sustainability of Metropolitan as a collective? I agree with Director Armstrong. I think the conversation that was had regarding AV was truly significant, because I think we, under your leadership, were able to get to a point to build consensus around something that was very controversial for many years. And I think the fact that we were able to get to that point of consensus was truly, truly significant. And I hope it's used as a starting point for the discussions going forward on the business model. But I've also heard the concept of additional connection fees being levied on new growth. And I would like to understand your perspective on that, given that, again, when we look around us here in this region, there's stranded capacity at the Skinner plant, stranded capacity at Mills. It's not a capacity issue. I think what we're talking about, at least from my perspective, is a water security investment, resiliency, reliability investment, and that we all need, that we all need to share in the cost. So I know there are two separate questions, and I apologize, but maybe if you can help us with your perspective on those issues, I would be appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, so on the issue of Pure Water, the region was not shy when we were pushing for Delta Conveyance to point to that project as the act of good faith that was going to prove that we were going to be responsible with our water use. We didn't do much. The project didn't progress very far, but it was on all the brochures. Look at what we're going to do. I wasn't on the board at the time, which is why I'm so cavalier in talking about it. On the Colorado River issues, we've been doing the same thing. We've gone to the federal government. We've gone to the state. We're accepting money. So if you want to find a sure bet way for us to lose credibility on the Colorado River issues in particular, we would walk away from that project. I don't think that it's a tenable thing for us to do that if we want to have any hope of attracting more federal funding for the other projects that we want. Which is why I think I want to praise our general manager for working with the members of Congress to do the opposite, which is to expand the amount of money that the federal government is willing to spend on large recycled water projects. So I think that, the project may be planned in a manner that scales up in a financially sustainable way. I think the other question that we have, and it goes back to the previous comments that I made about having your member agencies involved, we really don't know how much the people that are ultimately going to be buying that water for groundwater replenishment purposes and so forth are willing to pay for it. In the San Gabriel Valley, for example, they have a replenishment assessment that they've been making. It's called a replenishment development assessment that they've been charging their users. They have a ton of money. So far, they've been paying the full rate at Metropolitan to put that water into the ground without a discount. Is that sustainable? Is that something that they're going to want to do in order to finance their share of pure water? We don't know that. But I get your question, but to me it would be very unfortunate if Metropolitan walked away from it because it would undermine our credibility for everything that we've said for the last 30 years. On the question of what's ahead when it comes to growth and rates, one of the reasons that I've emphasized climate adaptation is because I think some of the arguments, for example, that would come out and say, well, the city of Los Angeles, for example, it's no secret that there's a belief within the Department of Water and Power that they've paid the historical cost of the whole system and that therefore it's not fair to assess them, you know, for new growth. My argument is we're not dealing just with new growth. We're dealing with climate change. So it's not the first time. When the pioneers came, all of Southern California, all of the state was desolate, sparsely populated, where people came from abroad and expected rivers to be in areas that were ideally places to live in. Well, we didn't have them, so they built them. We built these aqueducts, right? And we have the Southern California that we have today because of those investments. Now there's 40 million people in the state, half of them in this region. There's some areas that are growing. We're all tied together for the very same reasons that we were bound in the pioneer days. I mean, who helped to pay for that? It was the new growth area, which was everybody. So I think that, as I said in my opening comments, that our future rests on our measure of regional equity and the way that we fund that. And it's going to be one or the other. It's going to be where we all go into it together and we find a way to mitigate each other's costs, or we're all going to be on our own. And I can't see any in between because the future ahead, regardless of what we do, is going to be incredibly expensive for everybody.
Thank you, Chair Ortega.
Let me ask, if it's okay to ask Devin, if you want to add anything on this, or you're okay. So, well, one thing also I want to just add to what the chair said is also critical, that there's also agencies here that overinvested over time. And we need to recognize that as we are dealing with the growth. So it's a balance that we need to manage. So I think we're going to put all that at the table, and we need to address all of these things together. That's why the exchange idea is good. That's all the components, but also how we deal with moving and addressing growth. So I think all that is considered. But I don't want to forget there's others that now have ample water. They've invested for resiliency. Now they have available water that we can figure out how we can make it available to the growth in the system, how we can move it in the system.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for coming out. I like to remind people we are called Eastern because we're the easternmost part of the metropolitan system. So thank you for coming out today all the way to Eastern, and very much appreciated the comments, the questions, and thank you for coming.
President Pauly, if I can indulge the metropolitan team with a picture at the dais, if possible, we can come up.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's get the whole board. Yes.
Right here. Oh, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. All right.
All right. We're going to move on to item 6 on our agenda this morning, which is to receive and file various reports. Before I do, I want to make one quick comment. Board Administrative Committee, we got a report on our investments and investment management, and I just wanted to reach out and thank Tracy Lee and the whole team. Director Armstrong had asked for that. It was a wonderful presentation. So just a note on that. With that, I will look for a motion and a second to receive. Moved by Director Cronus, second by Director Slauson. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Yes.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-2-0. Director Record absent. That will bring us to our calendar review. Good morning, Sonia.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. For the what's new and events of interest portion of the calendar review, there are actually no new events to share today. So we're going to turn to page 2, which contains the current listing of the board members' master calendar for the next 2 weeks. If you would please review the information and let me know if there are any changes or updates. Page 3 is the list of the upcoming events with participants. April 19th is the Southern California Water Coalition quarterly luncheon meeting. April 26th through April 27th is the Colorado River Aqueduct Tour. May 7th through May 9th is the Aqua Spring Conference. May 9th is the Murrieta State of the City. May 23rd is the Paris State of the City. May 30th is the Temecula State of the City. And lastly, on June 18th is the San Jacinto Treatment Facility groundbreaking ceremony. Continuing at page 3 is the board meeting dates through the month of July. And these are all on schedule. Page 4 is the list of committee and interagency meetings. I do want to point out two changes here, and the first one is the April 18th executive committee time has changed to 3:30 p.m., and the second change is the July admin committee has been rescheduled to July 11th. On page 5, you will find the out-of-office schedule with one board member out of the area, May 17th through June 3rd. And for the district office holiday schedule, EMWD offices are closed on Monday, May 27th, and a Thursday, July 4th. This concludes my report on the calendar. Are there any questions or comments?
Nope. No.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We will go to director's activities reports. We will start with Director Armstrong.
Okay. I will just skip all of my metropolitan updates. I think that's more than covered today. So did have the Cal-DSAL Executive Committee meeting on Monday. Really reviewed the financial reports, and I got to say that that association just gets stronger, and I think the executive director, Glenn Farrell, is doing a fantastic job. Med has a rep on there, Warren Seitz, and he does a fantastic job as well. One action was the planning of the next annual conference, which will be in February, and looks like it might be at Pechanga this time. So it might be a good opportunity for more of our staff and board to participate. And I did offer a tour of our desalter if group would like to do that. So that's my updates.
All right. Thank you very much. Director Corona.
Okay. I did not attend the Myriad Temecula group. Rancho California Water District board meeting. That was the rate workshop that they had. I was only able to attend about half hour of it because I had to go to the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting that was being held at Rancho the same day. So, and then the joint facilities agreement, that was the briefing on that item we had today. And that's all I have.
Very good. I attended the joint Western-Eastern meeting where we had some our usual updates on regional issues. I had a coordination meeting with the Water Master to follow up on some of our discussions on allocations in the future. As usual, always good meeting with the General Manager. So the inaugural, our 75th anniversary planning committee, as you know, we're about to turn 75 next year. And I want to give April and Amanda kudos for coming up with some really good ideas to look at. I had a couple of my usual suggestions that I they didn't laugh at them outright, so that was a good start. But I do look forward to as we go along for our 75th year, and it's not going to be just one celebration. It's going to be the entire year of looking back at the history of this district and the history of this service area. So thank you for that. Was unable to attend the Riverside County Speakers Task Force. Had a good meeting with April on some of my, as I said, educational opportunities are big on my list here and how we can fulfill some of those. WRCOG was a good meeting, and Jolene told me she's already reached out to Chris Gray, and I do want to get him in here because he does have an excellent presentation on demographics and growth. Winchester Municipal Advisory Council, Alma did her usual good job. Caltrans was the speakers for the meeting, and I expressed to them the section of the 215 in front of the March Air Reserve Base, which in my opinion is deteriorating quickly, that is a route that a lot of our trucks take here at Eastern on a daily basis. And it's not just our agency, but I think many people that we represent in this area are starting to question what Caltrans is doing when you have 3- and 4-inch potholes that people are hitting. Their answer was that it is scheduled to be repaved in 2028. That's not a good answer for me. And I, at some point, may bring before this board a resolution. I know the city of Paris did one saying to Caltrans, what are we going to do about this? Because I think it is taking a toll on our vehicles. So that was my WRCOG update. And then I had a meeting with our new deputy general manager, Dan Howell, yesterday. And again, talking about some of the customer experiences and things. And I can just tell you, I am so pleased to have Dan in this position. That was certainly the right choice. And look forward to working with him over the next few years on implementing some of the things that I'm very interested in, which is our customer experience. So with that, Director Slauson.
Yes, I attended the Hispanic Chamber breakfast, and there were updates from the city and the school, and there was an update from insurance agency representative sort of discussing the state of the insurers in California right now and the move-out of several insurers. And Consuelo gave an EMWD update, and I attended an update with Joe, and we discussed different projects coming up, different things the district is facing. That's it.
All right, very good. Do we have any director's comments? Future agenda items? See none. I will ask legal counsel if there's a need for closed session today.
No need.
Very good. With that, we will stand adjourned until May 1st, 2024.
Thank you.